Good morning, everyone. I've called to order this regular meeting of the San Luis Obispo County Planning Commission. If the clerk will please call the roll.
Commissioner O'Grady?
Here.
Commissioner Christensen?
Here.
Commissioner Milskow?
Here.
Commissioner Wyatt?
Here.
Chairperson Wyatt?
Here. And we'll move to the flag salute. Everyone will please stand.
To the flag of the United States of America, to the Republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Public comment period. Anyone here to speak on any items not on the agenda today? Don't have any speaker slips, and seeing no one come forward, I will close public comment period and move on to planning staff updates. Ms. Griffin.
Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the Commission. I would just like to introduce you to the new director, Jason Giffen, and give him an opportunity to address you.
Thank you.
Good morning, Chairwoman Wyatt and members of the Planning Commission. My name is Jason Giffen. Spent my first 3 days here getting acquainted with all the various projects and plans that are being formulated here in the planning department as well as in the county. I'm very happy to be here. I look forward to working with all of you as well as stakeholders and residents as well as everyone here on county staff. So thank you very much.
You're welcome. Mr. Hogue, you have some additional comments for us?
I do.
Mm-hmm.
We're Department of Planning and Building. This is the typical, these are the dates you have upcoming, and I'm doing this deliberately because they're different. You know, they're not the regular second and fourth Thursdays in many circumstances. First, I wanted to remind the Commission that you have a joint meeting scheduled with the Board of Supervisors on Tuesday, October 12th. We know that some of you can't make it, and that's unfortunate, but I think it would be a wonderful opportunity for you to interact with the board. Your normal meetings will be on, you have a regular fourth Thursday meeting on September 23rd, and that's focused primarily on the Paso Robles groundwater study. Then September 30th, that's a fifth Thursday, we have normal business projects on that meeting. Then you're back to your normal schedule, October 14th and October 28th. Then you have the first Thursday in November and the third Friday, November 19th. It will be a Friday, not 18th, a Thursday. And then your last meeting of the year at this point is scheduled to be December 9th. That takes you through to the end of the calendar year. Again, if you have any questions on schedule, or if you know that your plans don't allow you to attend a meeting, please let Ramona or I know, or me know, and we'll make sure we note that in our records.
Quick question. So November has changed because on our schedule it showed the 12th or possibly the 18th, so it's going to be the 19th?
Yes, and we probably need to update that schedule. Maybe Ramona and I can put our heads together to do that for you. The 12th ends up being a Friday between a holiday and the weekend, and we were afraid that we might not get very good attendance. And then, so we moved to the next week, but we can't get the room on Thursday the 18th,
okay.
So that's why we're going Friday, November 19th. Okay. I'm sorry for the inconvenience. I know Thursday meetings are what you normally come to expect, but, you know, we need to take care of business, and because of the holidays in November and December, we have limited opportunities for meeting dates and getting this room, which is the real key. So,
thank you.
That's really all I had for staff updates, unless the commission has any quick questions for me.
Other questions for Mr. Hogue? Comments? Announcements? Okay. Thank you, Mr. Hogue.
Thank you.
We'll move on to our consent agenda. So we have only one item on our consent agenda, minutes from July 1st. Anyone here to speak to that or comments from the public? Okay, bring it back to the commission.
I'll move we approve the consent agenda.
Second.
Second.
Okay, motion and second. Any discussion? Seeing none, all in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
I have to abstain because I did not attend that meeting.
Okay, one abstention on those minutes. So with that, we'll move on to our regular hearing items. And if the clerk will please call item number one.
Hearing to consider a request by Barlson Family Trust and AT&T Mobility for a conditional use permit. County file number DRC 2008-00124, Supervisorial District 4, Erlen Singwall, Project Manager.
Thank you. Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the Commission, Erlen Singwall, planning staff. So the Barlson AT&T facility is back before your commission. This is a request by Barlson and AT&T Mobility for a conditional use permit to construct and operate an unmanned wireless telecommunications facility. And that facility would consist of 9 panel antennas mounted at a height of 65 feet and 1 microwave dish at a height of 16 feet on a new 70-foot tall faux eucalyptus tree. And if approved and constructed, this would be the first faux eucalyptus tree in the county. As you're aware, we have a few model pines. This would be the first eucalyptus. The project also involves the installation of 4 equipment cabinets within a 230-square-foot equipment shelter, and that shelter would have a fence around it to screen it from views along Highway 101, and also landscaping will be planted around the perimeter of the fence for additional screening. And the project also involves associated utility trenching about 682 feet along an existing agricultural road. Very briefly, a little bit of background. This project was before your commission on April 22nd of this year, at which time staff was actually recommending denial since it was located on the portion of the Bartleson Ranch that is zoned recreation, and a South County planning area standard had a limitation on use standard which did not allow a communications facility in the recreation category on the Bartleson Ranch. The outcome of that hearing was your commission continued the project off calendar to give the applicant time to submit a request for an ordinance interpretation about whether or not such a limitation on use standards should apply to a communications facility. The applicant was arguing that that standard should only apply to the primary use of the property and not an additional appurtenant or infrastructure use such as a communications facility. However, rather than submitting that request for an interpretation, the applicant just went ahead and relocated the facility to the other side of the Bartleson Ranch, which is zoned agriculture, where a communications facility would be in allowed use. There's the vicinity map. The project is on the Bartleson Ranch between Los Barros Road and Highway 101, about a mile and a half south of the city of Arroyo Grande. The address is 2080 Los Barros Road. Here's an aerial image, and I point out here the original project site was closer to 101 in the recreation land use category, which the next slide will show, and the project was relocated right here. As with the original proposal, this project is going to be located along an existing row of tall eucalyptus trees that range between 30 and 45 feet in height. And the property is actively farmed. The orchards adjacent to the project site right now are primarily citrus trees, and I believe avocado trees are planted in this area here. Here's the land use category map overlaid on top of the aerial photograph. You can see the original site was up here to the north in the recreation category. The proposed project site is very close to the boundary between ag and rec, but it is entirely in the agriculture land use category. And other land use categories in the vicinity include primarily agriculture, rural residential. This is the Los Barros Village area here. And the Leticia Vineyard is located across 101 here, where there's actually another communications facility, which I'll discuss briefly in a minute here. Here's the proposed site plan, and on the site plan, the applicant delineated the boundary between the ag and rec categories, showing that the project would be entirely within the ag category where it's allowed. In a large site plan, we have the equipment shelter here. 70-foot tall faux eucalyptus tree. Here are the elevations, antennas at a height of 65 feet on the faux eucalyptus, microwave dish at 16 feet, equipment, shelter, and the backdrop trees, the existing live mature eucalyptus trees, they range between 35 to 40 feet in height. Now, typically, we wouldn't support a faux tree that's so much taller than the adjacent mature trees. However, in this case, since there are no very close vantage points of the facility, the nearest vantage points are almost a mile away on 101 Los Baros Road, so that substantially diminishes the visibility of the faux eucalyptus tree. Just the utility plan showing the location of the utility trench. Now, staff conducted, with assistance from our GIS division, a viewshed analysis. And what this shows is all of the locations, I believe this is within a 2-mile radius, where, given the nature of the topography, the facility could be visible. And we are primarily concerned with visibility from the major transportation corridors, 101 and Los Baros Road, in this case. So the areas of concern are where the orange, which is the areas where it's visible, intersect with the major transportation corridors. And I circled the key areas of concern primarily here. This is about a half-mile stretch of Highway 101 where the facility would be visible. But then you can see as you continue on 101, due to the nature of the topography, it would be completely screened. And of course, this view set analysis does not take into account the screening effect of the existing mature vegetation in the area or any other structures that could obstruct views towards the project. But it's very helpful to give us an idea of where it would be visible and where it would not be visible. The applicant provided visual simulations from here on 101, along 101. This is really a worst-case scenario because it's about a 90-degree angle view, and this is actually taken from the frontage road on the property. And notice here that the faux eucalyptus is actually backdropped by the hills in the background. It's not silhouetting against the sky, and it's really, it doesn't result in a noticeable change to the character of the landscape, which is our goal in this case. And also, it's only visible for a very short stretch along Los Baros Road here, and again, it's backdropped by the hills in the background. And as you see, the orange also intersects 101 here and here, but those viewing locations are so far away that it would be a negligible visual impact. And now here's a photo simulation from on-site, much closer. This is looking up the existing ag road towards the facility. The utility trench would run along this ag road here. This is looking southwest from the other side of the orchard here at the faux eucalyptus from on site. And here's a larger image of the photo simulation from Los Baros Road. And this is just for that very small, I think it's about a 1,000-foot stretch of Los Baros Road that would be visible, and from 101 as well. Just briefly, our ordinance does require carriers to evaluate the feasibility of co-locating a facility at an existing facility before proposing a new facility. And this map here is our countywide wireless communications facilities map. Of course, this is just zoomed into the South County area. And you can see the nearest facilities to this project site are the Leticia Vineyard facility, which is located on a flagpole. And in this case, although that's an existing facility, the existing flagpole could not accommodate AT&T's antennas and wouldn't be able to screen AT&T's antennas, so that's really not a viable co-location alternative. Also, there's Picacho Peak, which is one of the major communications hubs in the county, and AT&T is already there. And of course, if that met their coverage needs, they wouldn't be proposing to build a new facility. I just have one revised condition, number 13. This was generated from a comment by Commissioner Melchow that possibly this requirement for fencing around the orchards could actually have a more of an impact on the agriculture than it would help. So the idea of this condition was to just ensure that the construction activities do not impact any of the nearby trees, and also we're proposing modification of the condition so that the orchards would either be fenced or, if as determined by the operator, the agricultural operator, visible stakes be planted in the ground around the trees so it wouldn't prevent access for agricultural purposes towards the orchards. So basically, we just added language about protective fencing and or highly visible stakes in the ground. And then the second sentence is important too. The applicant shall consult with the grower of the orchards to determine the appropriate locations for the protective fencing and determine when it would be more appropriate to use stakes rather than fencing.
I'm sorry, Mr. Singlewald, since we're here, what are we trying to do here? The fencing could be a problem for keeping things in, or?
No, let me explain. The protective fencing, the way it's written, says that will be remain in place for duration of the project construction. Well, who knows how long that'll be. In lemon orchards and avocado orchards, there's cultural operations going on all the time. And so you have to have a means to be able to get in and out of the orchard. Well, most agriculture roads and the trench for the 680 foot of trenching is supposed to be right along the edge of the road. Well, usually the edge of the road and the beginning of the trees generally is only a few feet. So if you put up a fence so that they can put the trench in and to remain during the project life of the construction of the project, the orchard operations are going to have a difficult time of getting in and out of the orchard. How are they going to do it? So my recommendation was, let's put stakes to show instead of the fence, and that allows the cultural operations to go on, and it also then will protect the trees where it will keep the trenching away from the trees and do the same thing as the fence. Mm-hmm. So that's my recommendation.
Okay, got it. I didn't know what we were doing there, so thank you.
Yeah.
While we were there, I thought we may as well look at it.
Mm-hmm.
Any other questions on that while we're right there? Okay.
And to conclude, staff recommends that your commission adopt the mitigated negative declaration and approve the project, and I'm available for questions.
Thank you, Mr. Singlewald. Before we open up to questions, any ex parte communications to disclose on this? Okay, seeing none. Any questions for staff, starting with the commissioner from the district?
Well, the only question I had was the one that we were talked about, so other than that, no, I have nothing.
It's out there. Okay. Any other questions for staff? Okay, Commissioner O'Grady.
Good morning, Mr. Singlewald. I see this faux eucalyptus tree is 70 feet in height. Was that the height of the monopine that was proposed before? And the other, when it was in the recreation site?
So it was still a faux eucalyptus when it was in the recreation site.
Okay.
And the height was shorter. I believe it was 60 feet. And, of course, that's because it was much closer to the highway. Now it's further from the highway, which is the primary coverage objective, so it needs additional height to provide the desired level of coverage.
Okay, so it was a coverage issue is why it grew. Okay.
Yes.
I think you said this was the first faux eucalyptus tree that we're going to have in our county. Have you actually seen one of those? Do they compare with the quality of the mono pine?
I've only seen photographs. Those photo simulations I showed superimpose an actual built mono eucalyptus, so that is exactly how they look, but I haven't seen one live in person.
Okay. And I guess it would be, I was looking at the slide of the trees in the area, and there's one on page 1-3 of our staff report. And I mean, I'm not a tree guy, but I don't know, those shorter trees, they look kind of round. Are those eucalyptus trees, or are they oaks, or what are those?
I know there is one large oak in the area, and there's also eucalyptus. I think the ones on page 1-3 are mostly eucalyptus trees, those, yeah. The tall ones.
Yeah.
They look like it.
Okay, all right. I'm just... I guess so. Also, it looks like on one of the drawings, it's kind of faded when I printed it out, but it looks like an emergency generator is part of the project. And if so, is that a natural gas power generator or is it diesel? And is there fuel?
The applicant could correct me if I'm wrong, but I don't believe there is an emergency generator as part of this project.
Well, they also showed on the one-line diagram with the automatic transfer switch, so maybe those are generic drawings. But anyway, that was a concern that I had also on the last project, as you recall. Okay, those are my questions.
Okay. Commissioner White?
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Mr. Singwall. My question is, did we get a distance that the project has been moved from the original location that was proposed?
I don't recall the distance off the top of my head. It is fairly substantial, I want to say, around about half a mile or so.
That leads to the next question. If the environmental determination took into account the relocation, were all the studies updated, or did they encompass an area that would cover the new proposed site?
Well, the environmental determination itself, the mitigated negative declaration in the initial study, evaluated the project at its current proposed location in the ag category. Some of the original environmental studies were looking at the old location. However, those were updated to evaluate the new proposed location. For example, the bioassessment. The applicant actually had a biologist go out there, do a site visit on the new location, and prepare additional recommendations to reflect the resources in the new location. As far as the cultural resources, the archaeological phase one site survey only looked at the original location, and we did not get an addendum for the phase one arch study because the new project site is located along an existing ag road, which has been previously disturbed due to a long history of agricultural activities and cultivation. And also, we're still able to rely on some of the analysis in the original ARC report, such as the record search, which showed that there are no known ARC sites on this property or nearby. And so between those two factors, the fact that the record search came up clean in this area, and also that it's in a previously disturbed area in an area that's not likely to support resources, we didn't require an addendum to the ARC report. And then as far as visual, we received a visual assessment for the original location closer to the highway, and for the new location, we just got revised photo simulations, and that's also why staff did that view shed analysis to sort of do an inter-department evaluation of the visual impacts.
Okay, thank you. One more question. Maybe this wasn't the case because it's on agricultural land, but historically, Pollution Control District has asked for a dust control speed limit of 15 miles per hour during construction. Is that waived off because we're on agricultural land?
Well, APC didn't respond to this project. I know sometimes they add that requirement. They didn't require that for this project. I don't know exactly why.
And what triggered that thought was on page 1-10, at the bottom of the page in the conditions, number 19, we have a biological protection speed limit of 25 miles per hour. And in previous projects, we've seen that conflict between air quality and the biological protection, Kit Fox specifically, and we've reduced that biological protection speed limit to 15 also. So I don't know if the commission would want to do that just for consistency. We could look at changing condition 19 to 15 miles per hour.
I think that's a good idea.
So
So let's come back to that then after we hear from the applicant and the public.
Okay, that's the extent of my question.
We could bring that back for discussion.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Commissioner White. Any other questions at this point? Okay, seeing none, let's open it to the applicant's agent and the public.
Good morning. Tricia Knight, representing AT&T. Staff did a great job. I know we've looked at this project before, and you know the history on it. And we're excited about the eucalyptus. There's so many of these in our county, even though they're not indigenous and can be somewhat pesky sometimes. But they really do allow for the screening, a little bit more height. The height in this situation is correct, even though we have facilities that are located on the hill behind. The traffic is still so heavy that this site is going to offload that traffic and allow for less dropped calls and better coverage in emergency situations. And it will also allow for co-locatability. So if another carrier comes and finds that same problem, this will allow for them to co-locate. So we picked a great company. So,
okay, so if you could look on 1-18, please.
Yeah.
And if you look inside the proposed shelter, on the right-hand corner of the shelter, there's a box that's cross-hatched.
Yeah.
That's not a generator?
That is not. That is for the air conditioning, I believe. Yeah, I can.
Okay.
I know AT&T, unlike Verizon, does not have emergency generators as part of their projects at this time. So.
I recall that, yes. Okay. All right. Well, thank you very much.
Other questions for the applicant at this point? Okay. Seeing none, we'll open it to the public. And I have a speaker slip from Michael Wynn. Anyone else who'd like to speak on this item, please get a slip in. Mr. Wynn.
Good morning, Chairman Wyatt. Commissioners, my name is Mike Wynn, and I live in Napomo, and I'm here to encourage you to approve this application. this is an area of Highway 101 that has a lot of dead spots for cell use, and even though we're all doing hands-free these days, it really is a vital part of public safety to be able to call in whether there's cattle on the highway or there's been an accident or whatever happens. And so be driving along and suddenly just have your connection go dead is a problem. We do need it. So that's one reason. Secondly, there's a certain irony in having the original location site turned down. The optimal site was clearly higher and closer to the freeway, and originally that was agriculture. The Bartleson family started about 15 years ago, Commissioner Melskow will remember, getting a general plan amendment to get that changed to recreation so they could put in a golf course. Lots of hearings, lots of fuss, as you can imagine, and then once it was done, and it was rezoned, but then they were not allowed to put in the golf course because they said they couldn't prove they had a water supply. So here's a use for agriculture on land that can only be used for agriculture. It was turned down because of a general plan amendment, which became dysfunctional. If you put it in a novel, trust me, it would be funny. It's not funny for the Bartleson family, I'm sure. So I would hope that you would, if you need to bend a little, I would hope you'd give them the benefit of the doubt on that. And last, I do want to comment very briefly that I'm intrigued by Commissioner O'Grady's suggestion that the environmental impact fees consideration should make faux native trees have precedent over faux non-native trees.
Is that what I said?
We're not going there. Could I suggest we not go there, please?
I know where you live, Mr. Wynn.
Anyone else here from the public to speak to this item? Okay, with that, we'll close public comment, bring it back to the commission. I've heard two changes to conditions here, issues brought up. So it looked like people were not in agreement with to the revised condition 13, as read by Mr. Singlewald, about the stakes fencing. Seeing no disagreement, I'll assume that's agreement. And then the other condition 19 that Commissioner White had brought up, changing the speed limit, decreasing that maximum, did I hear, to 15?
Yes.
So some discussion on that, or is there a general agreement that that's the way we'd like to go? Seeing nods, yes. Staff has some wording for that, and the applicant agrees that would reduce that maximum speed limit to 15. So could we just get some wording there? Mr. Singlewald, so we know what we're nodding off on?
So revised condition number 19, biological resources, would state the speed limit for travel on or near the site, including access routes, is 15 miles per hour. Speed limits and other traffic restrictions do not apply during emergencies.
Okay. Is that what you were looking for, Commissioner Wright?
Yes.
Commissioner Melskow?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Any other discussion or comments? Commissioner O'Grady.
Yes, I wanted to ask Mr. Singwald, because things change, if AT&T in the future wanted to add a generator, what would the implications be as far as them and the county, and what would happen then?
So the request, if there were a request in the future to add a generator, we would have to decide whether or not it's consistent with the approved conditional use permit. If we determine that it is consistent with the approved conditional use permit, then we would issue what we call substantial conformance determination, and we would allow the generator to be added. Of course, it would have to meet building code requirements as well as fire safety requirements.
Would it help to have a condition to that effect? Should a generator be added in the future, the applicant must contact the county and do what you just said, or is that not necessary?
The carriers are very good.
To adopt the mitigating negative declaration ED08-236 in accordance with the applicable provisions of CEQA. And number two, to approve conditional use permit DRC2008-00124 based on the findings listed in Exhibit A and the conditions listed in Exhibit B and condition number 13 as modified and read into the record by staff to allow stakes for limit controls on trenching instead of a fence, and number 19 to lower the miles per hour from 25 to 15.
I'll second.
Okay, so we have a motion and a second. If the clerk will please call the vote.
Commissioner Melskow?
Yes.
Commissioner White?
Yes.
Commissioner O'Grady?
Yes.
Commissioner Christensen?
Yes.
Chairperson Wyatt?
Yes. So with that, we have a unanimous vote to approve the project, and we'll move on to hearing item 2. Clerk, will please tell us what that is?
Continued hearing of a request by Brad Stahl for a reconsideration of a minor use permit. County file number DRC2007-00184, Supervisorial District 3, Brian Pedrotti, Project Manager.
Good morning, Mr. Pedrotti.
Good morning, Chairperson Wyatt and members of the Planning Commission. Staff recommends that the item be continued to a date certain. The applicant has requested the continuance due to ongoing meetings with County Council and the Board of Supervisors. And I believe we have a potential date on November 4th, if that's appropriate. We have some tentative time on that date. So.
Thank you, Mr. Pedrotti. Any discussion on this, Commissioner from the district?
I don't have any discussion. I'm fine with continuing. I don't know if these applicants are ever going to get where they want to go, but it's not taking a lot of our time, so if the staff's willing to keep going, I'm okay with that too.
Okay, and so anyone here from the public to speak to this item? We'll open up public comment before we come back for action. Okay, seeing no one from the public here to speak on this item, I'll close public comment. And if there are no other discussion or questions, did I hear a motion?
Yeah, I'll go ahead and move that this item number 2 regarding a request from Brad Stahl for minor use permit, County file number DRC2007-00184, be continued to a date certain, November 4th.
Okay, and a second?
I'll second.
Okay, with that, we have a motion and a second. All in favor?
Aye. Aye.
Okay, with that, unanimously approved a continuance of this item to 4 November. And we'll move right on to item number 3.
Continued hearing to consider an appeal filed by John J. Flynn III of Nossaman, LLP, on behalf of San Miguelito Partners, LP, of a planning director determination. County file number DTM 2010-00001, Supervisorial District Number 3, Brian Hostetter, Project Manager.
Good morning, Ms. Hostetter.
Good morning, Commissioners. Ryan Hostetter, County Planning Staff. This is a continued hearing from your August 26th meeting on San Miguelito Partners Planning Director Determination. And at the last hearing, the Commission directed staff to go back and revise findings to uphold the appeal of the Planning Director Determination. And that is a part of your package is Exhibit A. I did want to point out a couple things since we've last met on August 26th. When we went back to revise the findings and we looked into some questions from Commissioner O'Grady, which have been posted regarding grading activities, essentially, staff, along with County Council, started reviewing the ordinance further. And in our memo we have for you today, dated September 7th, we've outlined a section, which I will go through here on the screen in just a moment, that would require a grading permit for the proposed project. So if you don't mind, if I can jump into that, unless you want to ask any questions before we outline that. No?
Okay. Go right ahead, then we'll get to other questions.
Okay. Can we pull the screen up? On the screen before you is the exemption number 6 here by my cursor, which is what the commission had asked us to look into as far as not requiring a land use permit for the installation of the 305020. So as we looked into this, we went to the grading permit section, 2305020, and I'm going to bring that up next. We went to the grading permit section. Grading permit required in our coastal zone land use ordinance. And we first looked through the exemption section because there are exemptions from grading permits. And they're outlined, they're all on this page in front of you. It goes A through H. And we could not find an exemption that we felt would be applicable to this proposed project. And just quickly, the first exemption would be for excavations of basements or footings for a building, cemetery graves, excavations or fills for subdivision map projects, which have CDPs, agricultural cultivation, surface mining operations, excavations less than 2 feet in depth, and there are a couple other criteria in there. We actually communicated with the Public Works Department, and the water lines are, in order to put a water line in, it's a minimum of 3 foot required in our Public Works codes. And we can go into that, or Glenn Marshall can potentially go into that if you have questions. And then fill less than 1 foot in depth. And then this exemption here really has similar language to the exemption that we were using from a land use permit. And it discusses exemptions for pipelines distributing less than 1,000 square or less than 1,000 square feet in size, and, or installation, testing, placement, or replacement of necessary utility connection between existing facility and individual customer or approved development. So this would be the exemption potentially that we could use, except for it goes on to say that this exemption does not apply if you're in the following areas. And staff feels that all four criteria actually apply to the project. It's within an appealable area, and I have a map that's also in your package, but I'll bring up a color version that's a little clearer. We know we're in an archaeologically sensitive area here. We're within 100 feet of environmentally sensitive areas, and extensions of water service outside of an urban services line. So we felt that none of these exemptions would apply for a grading permit.
Ryan, while we're on that point right now, if you don't mind, it seems like number four, even though I agree with you, it does not allow any exemption for a grading permit. It almost reiterates that we do have services outside the urban services line.
That's
the whole
point
that we're discussing here and last time we were here.
Sure.
So it shows like that it acknowledges that does exist.
Sure. I believe Templeton? No, that's not in the coastal zone, though. I'm trying to think if we have an instance where this actually occurs, and I don't know.
I just wanted to point that out while we were here. So, thank you.
So, because we couldn't find any exemption from a grading permit, and it would meet at least... it's in an appealable area for sure. That's when we go to this sentence here for a grading permit. And I'm going to highlight this for you. And I'm going to read it as well. Where a grading permit application proposes a project that is not otherwise subject to land use permit requirements or other applicable section of this title, a grading permit approval certifies that the proposed project will satisfy all applicable provisions of this title and thereby constitutes approval of a coastal development permit. And then it says where a grading permit is appealable to the Coastal Commission, a minor use permit approval is also required. So that is where we have our second set of findings, which would mimic what the commission outlined at the previous hearing as far as the USL determination and extension of services, and amending the second issue as far as installation of the water lines and requiring a grading permit and a minor use permit per this section. So... based on that information, we're available for questions. We did receive a letter from the Coastal Commission yesterday after
the go-ahead of the project without having to move the urban services line, but I did believe that there were permits required. So I was thrilled to see this additional research and memo from staff, and I agree with everything they're saying. So I'm fine.
That's all I have. Okay, questions at this point. Questions at this point. Seeing no other questions, then let's open it up to the public. And starting with the appellants, I apologize. At the last hearing, I wasn't too clear on who the appellants are. I've got about 6 speaker slips, so we generally afford a little extra time to the appellants or their agents. So, sir, is that you representing?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay, and you are?
My name's Dave Watson.
Okay, and Mr. Watson, so how much time would you like?
I'm going to try to start off by keeping it down to the 3 minutes, and then I'm going to turn it over to Mr. Flynn or Mr. Sanders to wrap it up.
Okay.
We thought we'd mix it up just to keep with this tenor of everything that you've been hit with over the last couple of weeks.
Mr. Watson, this is Jim Orton from County Council. At the last meeting, you indicated you represented a property owner who had applied for a permit.
Yes,
and my understanding that Mr. Flynn and the other attorney were representing the appellant. Are you now representing the appellant, San Miguelito Partners?
I'm a co-represent. Mr. Howard, the owner of the property.
All right. I just wanted to clarify because you didn't represent them at the last meeting.
You're technically correct once again, and I appreciate that.
Okay. So with that, I will also just remind you, we generally afford the applicants or appellants and their agents 10 or 15 minutes. So I'll trust that if there are 3 or 4 of you, that will be 3 minutes each.
That's our intention.
Okay.
Thank you very much. With the ground rules set, I feel a little bit like Alice in Wonderland. Every time I'm back here in front of you, I'm going to find a new threshold or hole to deal with. So I'd like to stop coming back if I can and try to come to some sensible closure today with you if possible. Thank you for the opportunity to stand up first. Planners and attorneys are not always complimentary, and in this particular case, I think there's a lot of big technical issues, but I again want to try to remind you to frame the issues as it relates to the questions that you were presented with, and then we'll do the best we can on the fly this morning to address the new stuff. both from staff and from the Coastal Commission, which we only received yesterday. I have passed out a set of findings that we would ask you to consider today. It's a two-page or a two-sided sheet of paper that staff looks like they're passing out now. There are really still two issues that we want you to address today. The first is the question of the LCP amendment issue. I think in the form of the staff's presentation, we're going to try to address Exhibit A of their package. That's where we started. Again, it's difficult to keep track of what we're supposed to be addressing, but that's where we're going to start. I would ask you to consider some changes to findings A, B, and C to more accurately and completely address the issues that have come up, both as it relates to your consideration and as it relates to the Coastal Commission's efforts to participate in this process. The changes on finding A that are on the sheet address the specifics of delivery of water by CSA 12 to the properties. We're talking about domestic water supply. We're talking about the use of water inside a residence. We are also asking you on finding A to consider the deletion of the last sentence as somewhat editorial. I don't think it gets to the meat of the conversations the commission had at the last meeting. And I'd encourage you to take a look and dialogue on that if you would. With regard to finding B gets to the heart of the issue of the LCP amendment. We have suggested that you add a sentence to that and add clarification that, in effect, I'll read it to you. The subject properties are located within the sphere of service, which under your LCP is the urban services line equivalent. That is very clear from the tables and the charts and the testimony that you received and from Mr. Hogue's confirmation of that in his presentation to you before the break last meeting. We've asked you to do that because it's particularly important to recognize that CSA 12 is a legitimate services district formed for the purposes of delivering water to the site. We think that's important because then the balance of the findings the staff has presented become clearer to the parties that may look at this down the road. On the second page, we've asked you to consider making it clear once again that what you're saying is we don't need to amend the Avila Beach Services District USL. Now, the policies doesn't say which USL. It says a USL. And we're simply contending, and I think you agree, that the CSA 12 boundary is a legitimate, if not functionally equivalent, USL. The last issue gets to the latest issue that's come before you, and rather than process the plans for the home. So that's what's motivating us to move through this issue with you today. For the record, we acknowledge the requirement to get a construction permit, but I would encourage you today to think about, as this proceeds, a distinction between a grading permit as a land use entitlement, which is what both staff and the Coastal Commission are arguing you require us to do in the form of an MUP, versus a construction permit, which is provided the attended exemptions that exist in your code and in the Coastal Act, which is the basis for why we are in front of you. So please take the time to query and understand today that when you approve a coastal permit, you then move to the next step, which is a construction permit. And a grading permit is a construction permit. In fact, we had applied for an encroachment permit from your Public Works Department to install the water line. We submitted plans to them showing the grading and the line installation to provide service to Parcel 2. That's what triggered this appeal process. Staff refused to issue an encroachment permit until we went through an amendment of the USL. So with that as an introduction, I might have taken more than 3 minutes. I would like to turn it over to the attorneys and allow them to follow up. Thank you. I'm happy to answer questions.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Watson. So
I would just indicate that the findings that were distributed are different than the ones that Mr. Flynn and Mr. Sanders had emailed the staff. So I hope they would clarify which ones they want us to focus on. Thank you.
Okay. So with that, Mr. Flynn and Mr. Sanders, did you want to follow up?
And Mr. Flynn, did you want 5 minutes and to split your 10 with Mr. Sanders?
I think that would be perfect.
How would you like
thank
to
you.
Proceed? So if we could put 5 minutes on, Ms. Hedges?
Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the Commission. My name, as you know, is John Flynn, and I do represent San Miguelito Partners in connection with the appeal of the director's determination in this case. One of the first things that I'd like to address is the point that Ms. Hostetter made about whether there is an exemption to the grading permit requirement. That's not an issue that we addressed or had an opportunity to address last time. It has been raised for this meeting, and if I could ask Ms. Hostetter to go back to the grading ordinance, specifically 23.05.026, which is the exemption section. If we can get that back up on the screen, I'd like to call your attention to one part of one of these exemptions at F, and unfortunately this part was not quoted during the presentation. F reads, an excavation which is less than 2 feet in depth or which does not create a cut slope greater than 5 feet in height and steeper than 1 1/2 horizontal to 1 vertical. So in either case, the exemption would apply. Grading permits are required for alterations to landforms, changing drainage courses, significant alteration to landforms, not to trenching for installation of pipelines, because you're not going to cause a significant change to the landform in that case. That's why you have the second part of F, which says, or which does not create a cut slope greater than 5 feet, and so forth. Now, we haven't got to the point, obviously, where we've submitted an application for a grading permit, but the grading plans will obviously be submitted along with the application, and those grading plans will show that, in fact, we will satisfy the second part of the exemption described in sub F. So, in fact, there is an exemption to the requirement for a grading permit. The staff report has based the need for a grading permit, has based on that need for a grading permit, the need for an MUP, which gets you to a CDP. But if you take away the need for a grading permit because of this exemption, you don't have the foundation you need for an MUP. Okay. I'd like to briefly address the Coastal Commission letter that we got at 9 o'clock last night. We haven't had a prior opportunity to review the letter. I have reviewed it. I don't think it adds anything of substance to what we've already talked about at great length about both the USL and the statutory exemption provided by 30610F. However, if any members of the Commission believe there are questions raised at the property, be satisfied, and we all know indisputably that it will be. That's what I think it comes down to. And as I said, if you do believe there are questions, additional questions raised by the Coastal Commission letter that we need to address, I'd be happy to answer those. But that really concludes my remarks, and Mr. Sanders, I don't think he has any additional comments. Thank you all.
Thank you. Any questions for Mr. Flynn at this
yes,
point?
Yes, I have one, Madam
Mr.
Chair.
White?
Mr. Flynn, you referenced number F there under the exemptions, but it still doesn't answer the question that you're in a zone that these exemptions don't qualify for. At the bottom
I don't think that's correct.
Could we pull those up again?
No, at the bottom of the ordinance, my understanding was there's 4 criteria.
Could we scroll down to those criteria past F?
That was that paragraph that I originally pointed out was exemptions from the land use permit section, and that's a different section of the ordinance. So what we're talking about at the moment is grading permit exemptions, and these are just simply exemptions from a grading permit, and they end right here. So,
but if you scroll back up right there where we have down a little bit further, where you have 1, 2, 3, and 4.
Right.
I didn't think these exemptions applied to any of those areas.
1, 2, 3, 4 go along with H.
Just with H.
Yep.
So the exemptions do apply to all the other, even if they're within
the
those areas.
If the project meets A through G, then potentially, however, we feel that there's no way it can meet any of those others, and we can talk about that when
so
we're done.
It could just meet one of any one of
sure.
these.
Yes.
And as Mr. Flynn's pointing out, F. And just to clarify Mr. Flynn's position on F, that thank you for that clarification. I misunderstood that. So, when you read F, you know, we're talking about 2 feet or, we're talking about exemptions, 2 feet or the cut and fill. So the way I understand your position is that you may exceed the 2 feet, but you're not going to exceed the cut fill. So therefore, it just says or. It doesn't say and or.
That's correct.
So it could be one or the other.
That's the way it reads.
Yes, that's what I interpreted also. So I just want to get that clarification. So if anyone has a question on that, we can discuss that.
Okay, so that will come up later, I expect. So noted. Other questions at this point? Okay, so we'll move on then. Thank you. With public
Thank
comment
you.
Then, Mr. Sanders has seated. A time, or did you want still another few moments?
Madam Chair, members of the Commission, Gregory W. Sanders representing the appellant, I have nothing to add.
Okay, that's quick. We like that, Mr. Sanders. We like
sure.
that. With that, we have slips from Mr. Howard and Mr. Wynn. If there is anyone else here to speak to this item, please do get your speaker slip in. So with that, Mr. Howard? You're okay, too. All right, we're on quick is good. And so, Mr. Wynn.
Good morning, Chairman Wyatt again. My name is Mike Wynn, and I'm from Pomo, but I also do serve as the chair of the county's Water Resource Advisory Committee, and that just means that we can give advice that everybody's free to ignore, so I don't want to put too much weight on that.
So noted.
But appreciate the opportunity to speak for you today. I just want to speak to the two findings, A and B, in Exhibit B, and make a couple of very commonplace observations. The first is that any time that we can get water delivered to a site that's close to the ocean instead of putting in a well next to the ocean, we've probably done a good thing. We do not have any history of seawater intrusion at this site, so far as I know. Although it's pretty much unmonitored, so that's just an assumption. But this, I think, would make good sense from a public policy perspective. The other has to do with the general use of urban service lines. Urban service lines in this county are largely ignored. In fact, they've been moribund for more years than I can count. The subdivision that I live in Napomo, was built outside the urban services line, and has been so for over 20 years. It is served by the Napomo Community Services District, and we have many, many places in this county where it's not used. In fact, when the SOI discussions came up with your planning department and then with LAFCO, we argued that the urban services line should be discontinued countywide as a planning tool, because we are served well by the urban service, the urban reserve line, outside of which we don't provide certain kinds of services. And then the SOI, the sphere of influence line, which is a LAFCO tool for 20-year planning envelope. It was not removed at the time, but there's no function to it at all. It simply isn't being used. My house is 2 blocks outside the urban services line, and I have no difficulty with the urban services. If there is some genuine use for
pending before this commission and this county, in effect, prejudging, at least apparently so, on behalf of the commission, if it does come to the commission at some point, prejudging the matter by way of a letter from a Coastal Commission staff member. I think that is very troubling. It's putting aside the fact that we got it so late last night. A Coastal Commission staff member has the right to express opinions like anyone else, but it wasn't couched as an opinion. There's a ring of authority to that letter that I don't think is appropriate in this situation. That's the one final comment that I wanted to make. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Flynn. With that, we'll close public comment and bring it back to the commission. And commissioners, prefer a break before we come back for discussion? It's almost time for a break. So what I would propose is we take that now and we come back at 10:25 from a short morning break and get into discussion on this item. Okay, so with that, we'll come back, reconvene at 10:25. And we're in the middle of our item three. We've just closed public comment, and so we'll bring it back if staff had some responses to public comment.
Yes, Ryan Hofstetter, County Planning staff. We have a couple things. First, we would like to note for the record that we are processing a minor use permit, coastal development permit, for one of the lots for Mr. McCarthy. So I think Mr. Watson incorrectly stated that we were refusing to process, or we weren't processing that application, which we are. We've done site visits with the architect. We've gone to Avila Advisory multiple times. And we are waiting to hear the outcome of this as to whether they were going to propose either on-site water or continue with CSA 12 water. So, but for the record, we are processing that application. And also, we just wanted to note that Mr. Flynn, his comments about the Coastal Commission letter being troubling coming at such a late hour on an item such as this, we would like to point out that, right or wrong, the Coastal Commission has their responsible agency, and they are going to have review authority over these issues. So, right or wrong, they are going to be reviewing this, and they've already started to review the minor use permit for which we sent a referral for, and they called staff yesterday because they've been watching the Planning Commission video feed from the previous hearing, and that's why they sent this letter. So, I just wanted to point out that what we're trying to do here is resolve the issue locally and get a solution here without having to have Coastal Commission step in with potential enforcement actions or things of that nature. So I just wanted to point that out.
Thank you, Ms. Hofstetter. And sure, Mr. Marshall?
Sure. Adding on, Glenn Marshall, County Public Works, just adding on to staff comments, some of the things that I had heard that are probably more applicable to Public Works is, first and foremost, I think I should state that the applicant is requesting an exemption, looking at these different titles under the grading permit and underneath the coastal permit applications. They're looking for exemptions that Public Works, if this were a Public Works project, we would not be looking at. We don't feel, the county doesn't feel, that there is a valid exemption to constructing this water line up Cave Landing Road. So, assuming... Going with the applicant, though, they had said under the grading permit that an excavation, I'm looking at F on section 2305020, once again, we would not be looking at this as being an exempt project if this were a public works project. But under 2205020 number F, it says basically an excavation which is less than 2 feet in depth, which this definitely doesn't qualify for. Our public improvement standards say for waterline installation in a public road, which would be an encroachment permit requirement, they have to follow our standard public improvement standards for trenching, which for a waterline requires a minimum 3 feet of cover, plus the depth of the pipe, whatever size that might be, plus a minimum of 6 inches of bedding. So assuming it's a 6-inch pipe, you're down 4 feet just in the trench. Secondly, it says, or which does not create a cut slope greater than 5 feet in height and steeper than 1.5 to 1 horizontal. Well, the cut slope for a trench is completely vertical. It is steeper than 1.5 to 1, so it wouldn't be applicable here as well. Regardless of, once again, we would not be looking for an exception to this. And then secondly, I think Mr. Watts had mentioned that they had applied for an encroachment permit. I'm unaware of an application. However, I did review the handout that Mr. Watson had provided us, the conceptual design, and this conceptual design is not enough information to issue an encroachment permit. They'd have to have final design plans, alignment, depths, trench details, blow-offs, all the components of the water line for us to issue an encroachment permit. So I kind of am suspect that...
And again, what was your minimum depth? The water line?
For a water line, it's minimum, well, for an 8-inch or smaller pipe, it's a minimum cover of 3 feet. And then you'd have the width or the diameter of the water line plus the bedding.
So they could stay out of the 5-foot?
They could stay out of the 5 foot, but they couldn't stay out of the 1.5 to 1, because I think it says 5 foot and less than 1.5 to 1.
Yes, and again, that to me, I
you interpret again, it
not to be argumentative.
Yeah,
I really can't interpret that as grading to
right.
Make a trench. So.
Regardless, I don't think Public Works would be looking at that exemption if we were trying to become exempt from a waterline project in the coastal zone. We'd be looking at number H, and it clearly says, hey, you can't do it.
Right,
you need
right.
to get a permit. And that's what we'd be looking at.
Well, that's what I was hung up on.
Yeah.
I thought that H prevailed, but then it was clarified that any of these exemptions could qualify.
Sure.
Madam Chair, may I interject a comment? Warren Hub, Department of Planning and Building. I think historically the department has administered exemption F for lot grading, but not for utility trenching.
Mm-hmm.
Again, it's up to your commission to interpret this, and it says what it says. But I think it's useful to know that we've generally used it to look at lot grading, not utility trenching.
Okay, then to follow up on another question is that if there is a minor use permit being processed and a coastal development permit being processed, I believe that let me find my bearings here, that Mr. Watson in the previous hearing asked if we could consider this waterline under that permit if we don't agree that there should be an exemption. Could that be part of that permit process?
We could potentially amend the project description of that minor use permit and process it with that, sure.
Well, and I want to ask Mr. Watson, am I getting that correctly? And would that be a for lack of a better word, I don't even want to use that word. Would that be agreeable to the appellants?
Commissioner White, Commissioners, Dave Watson, the issue before you is whether or not we're talking about a grading permit that requires a use or land use approval CDP. And the issue comes down to whether you distinguish that from a construction grading permit, which we believe we did, Glenn, with all due respect, submit in a proper fashion. The encroachment permit that's pending. So our fallback, if you choose that the land use approval is necessary, our fallback is to either work through an appeal process on that or simply acquiesce to including it into the home permit. We want to see the house get in front of the commission. We want to see it approved as AVAC has recommended. We're in a position where, with all, again, all due respect, we've been prevented from filing the application and moving forward through the process until these issues are resolved. So I think the Solomon wisdom that we're looking for this morning is, does everything that you've looked at push you in the direction that a grading permit is a use permit, or if not, it's a construction permit? And if that's the latter, then the application for encroachment that's pending can simply be resolved directly with Public Works. So it's a roundabout way of saying, we hope that you will find that this is not a land use discretionary grading permit entitlement that we're seeking, but rather simply to implement a CDP that was issued when the law line adjustment recognized these homes, these sites for residential construction 15 years ago. Hope that answers your question.
I think so. Thank you.
Okay, so there are other questions for staff at this point. Questions? Commissioner O'Grady?
Does Title 23, the inland LUO?
Title 22 is inland.
Does that, if this project were inland and we were talking about whether a minor use permit, land use permit was required, what would the answer be?
I don't have that language in front of me, but I believe that this language at the end of this is specific to the coastal zone because it talks about grading permit application being a CDP, and when in an appealable area that requires the grading permit and a minor use permit. So it's not... The grading permit and minor use permit are not the same thing here. This language is saying that when a grading permit is appealable to the Coastal Commission, where my cursor is, I'm sorry, can you bring that up, Ramona? So it says where a grading permit is appealable to the Coastal Commission, whereas if we determine that a grading permit is necessary, a minor use permit is also required. So this is different. This language would not be in our inland ordinance.
To further answer your question, we just amended the inland grading ordinance, and there's a very comprehensive and complicated.
So, Commissioner from the district, do you want to have the pleasure of starting us off here, or do you want me to? Or
well, I appreciate the input from the applicants and from the staff. I basically kind of still believe what I thought last time, and still think at the thought of the beginning of this time, which is that I am comfortable with not requiring the expansion of the urban services line, because I'm not sure that the staff put it in exactly the words I would have used, because my basic reasoning is that the intent of requiring the urban services line to be expanded has been met by the fact that there is water that's been obtained by this applicant. And I appreciated Mr. Wynn's comments. At the same time, as I said last time and as I still think now, I do believe that a grading permit is required, and I don't think it meets the exemption, and apparently because of the language, minor use permit is also required because it's in the coastal zone, an appealable coastal zone. So I'm comfortable with the findings in Exhibit B, maybe with a slight tweaking of the first one to talk about my intent idea, but other than that, I'm good. But it sounds like the rest of us are probably going to be all over the place, so I think we should have a little discussion before we see if we've got any consensus.
I think that's right. So anyone else want to throw out some ideas, or I have a list of issues here, but let me just throw them out here before we get more discussion. I just, as I expressed in the last meeting and was the lone sort of voice here, I've got a lot of issues with this, and I really firmly think we should uphold the planning director's determination and deny this appeal on several counts. And just going through them, I do think the USLs are there for a reason, and they're there to kind of prevent hopscotching development out of certain areas. And I think the applicant and Mr. Wynn has well pointed out, may well be right that there are some problems with that. But as written in our Public Works Policy 1, it's clearly required that areas outside of these that are subject development have water on site. So I would look at my colleagues here and ask, could you please pull up Ms. Hostetter Public Works Policy 1 again? I never heard at our last discussion any suggestion that Public Works Policy 1 isn't perfectly clear from my colleagues. And I would ask you how we can just ignore that. I didn't hear any suggestion that that's unclear or ambiguous. What I heard is that shouldn't apply because we don't like it. And Commissioner Christensen asked why we're here looking at this with these complicated legal arguments, and it's our job to apply our ordinances of our general plan. And I guess I'm still looking for some reason why that doesn't apply amongst others, and that's my primary issue here. So maybe there's some response to that. Okay, so permitted development outside the USL shall be allowed only if it can be serviced by adequate private on-site water. So are you indeed calling this private on-site water? And proposed development, environmentally preferable. Okay, I did hear your arguments for environmentally preferable, but there I would say we're not yet looking at a project. So that troubles me because we don't have environmental documents for a project. So how we can make that determination without more evidence, it troubles me. If we look at that, maybe we can make that determination, but I don't see it here. So did I hear some kind of decision that this qualifies? I heard the appellant argue that this is private on-site water, but I didn't hear any of the commissioners agreeing with that, and I think that's very important because I think that's clear. Private on-site water, and this is water coming from off-site, and that begs the issue of water wheeling on rural properties, which I think is also a very important issue that we need to think about, because we're not discussing that here because we don't have a project and we don't have environmental documents. We're seeing water wheeled around areas of the county.
And that's part of the reason this policy is in effect, because if we're going outside USLs, then water needs to be provided privately on the site. What we're seeing here is water wheeled and brought in from somewhere else. The applicant over the last 10 or 15 years of the project has looked at bringing water in from various places. We've seen applications from Pismo. We see this from Lopez. There may well have been discussions with Avila. There probably have been looks at the on-site potential. And we need the opportunity to look at the consequences of this wheeling around. It may be fine, and this may well be the best alternative, but I don't see how we can make so the suggestion that this weigh-in is anything new. I think we could refute that. We see suggestions from letters from the Coastal Commission regularly. It would be ideal if we didn't receive any correspondence at the last minute, but that's not abnormal. I would argue it's a waste of public money and private money to carry this through. But, of course, our commission has authorization to do what we need to do here, so we're not going to prejudge because of Coastal Commission comments. But they're holding pretty firm on this, as is our staff and by our planning director determination. And we also see over the course of the history of this project, of the 10 or 15-year history, we've seen the appellant's own application in 2001 for a USL change to do this when they were looking at bringing water in from Pismo. They weren't looking at bringing water from Avila then. They were looking at bringing water from Pismo. And they knew, because staff has been consistent and the Coastal Commission since the letter of 1998, that the USL needed to be changed. So it's not some new requirement that's been just pulled out of the hat yesterday that this needs to be changed. It was there already in a letter from the Coastal Commission in 1998 for Pismo water. So it's not sudden news that they need to be in the USL. Of course, the appellant wants to move this project forward, and that's their choice. But we have consistent decisions from both the Coastal Commission direction on this and from our own planning staff over more than a decade. So we're not looking at some new rules changing here. We're looking at a consistent application of the rules. And for us to just change it and suggest, none of these decades of consistent recommendations matter, seems to me not a prudent way to go. So those are the main issues I have here. I've got issues with the appellant's suggestion that this private work is a public work. I think there's a real danger in calling this private utility line to serve private parcels a public work. And I think we have a majority of commissioners that agree that's not the case at the last meeting. But I hope we'll hold that here. Public works projects are things like public purpose, libraries and schools. So how we want to possibly act on calling this a public work also troubles me a bit. I don't see any of it there.
I think we'll talk, you're going back to a discussion we had last time, but did you have any further comments to make on the second part about the permit?
No, I wanted to go back on the information, and I wanted to attempt to sway you on these first parts, because I think it's a mistake on the first part, and I don't think we have new information that affects that. And so, yes, I'm hoping to re-sway you on the first part, first of all, to rethink some of that, because if Commissioner O'Grady is question,
you want a response, I am not swayed. I would like to stick to my last statements last week time, and I'm going to stick to them this time. I think that the name, I understand your comments, and I guess it is one of the reasons I asked what we were doing here, because to me, if it was cut and dried, we wouldn't even be here. So the fact is that we do have a room for some room for decision making, and I look at policy one and it says availability of service capacity, and it talks about having to extend a USL to ensure availability of service capacity. In this situation, that is not the case. So to me, the intent of this policy is met. There is water. It doesn't come from Avila or Pismo, and it's going to be accounted for. I feel the intent is of the policy is met. We talked about this last time. I also think that, and it kind of gets to Mr. Wynn's comments and some other comments that have been made, that to insist that the water come from on site when probably all of us know by now that common sense tells us drilling wells right next to the coast is not a good idea. So when, if there was no water somewhere else, I'd be going, okay, they haven't shown any water. But they're not talking about water that they're going to get. They're talking about water they've had, they've been paying for. So to me, to insist that we expand the USL and or require that they start drilling wells right next to this, right next to the coastline, literally, you know, that just seems like following technicalities for non-common sense reasons.
And so how can you get around these very specific A and B?
I'm getting around it because I've been asked to say whether I think the USL should be expanded or not, and I say no. That's how I'm getting around it.
But that's our policy as written there. So are we
sometimes our policies? Sometimes our policies as written don't capture the intent very well, and I think the intent of this policy is met. That's how I'm getting around. So anyway, I think that we, I mean, unless we have a difference of opinion from the rest of the commissioners, I think we...
Your point of view on this particular thing. I did say at the last meeting that while I'm a stickler for following ordinances, when they lead me over the cliff, I think you have to step back and take a second look. And the step back for me was that I thought drilling wells on this site was an environmentally inferior approach that would be what the alternative that the developer would be left with if we do insist on preventing off-site water from being delivered. Now that said, we'll get into findings later, but it's only an environmentally superior alternative if granting of this appeal can prohibit on-site wells from being drilled in the future. While I agree with this part one, I just wanted to throw that out there for discussion either now or later, but let's not leave that altogether until we've had a chance to thrash that out as staff and the and legal, if that's a possibility. So that's what I had to say on part one.
Thank you, Mr. White.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yeah, just to respond to a couple of your comments, you know, a lot of complicated issues here and a lot of interpretations, and I think the appellant has done a good job outlining the position that I tend to agree with, and probably first and foremost is the practical, if not legal, definition of the sphere of influence for CSA 12 is equivalent to a USL, because it, from a practical matter, that sphere of influence is where CSA 12 serves, and this falls within that boundary. And Mr. Wynn testified earlier here today that that's throughout our county, the CSD's service areas, and it's within their realm of service or sphere of influence that fall outside USLs on a continuous basis. And you know, I have some experience with that up in the North County. So, you know, just that alone is enough in my mind to go the direction that we're going here on that. And then I wanted to, you talked about public works, being libraries and hospitals and those types of things. That could be true, but like I said in the last hearing, you know, terminologies can have more than one definition. And I respect the Public Works Department's definition of the county's definition of public works, but as the appellate pointed out, there's nothing in the Coastal Act that defines public works with that limitation. And furthermore, you know, all of these projects that are done for public utilities and services, in my mind, are a public works project, even though they don't meet that definition that our own Public Works Division has. They're not inspected by a building department. They're inspected by Public Works, or they're inspected by the private engineers, and they're signed off by Public Works. So they don't even run through the building and planning department. So, just for those reasons alone, you know, I'm willing to go along with the direction that we're headed here.
Thank you. I hope that helps.
Thank you. Thank you for the responses. Okay, so with that, let's move to part two, unless Mr. Marshall wanted to respond to the comment about public works. Or no, okay, I wasn't sure if that was leaning forward in on that or not.
Just checking.
So with that, let's move on to part two. And so it does sound like there are some different kind of directions people want to go on that. So why don't the commissioner from the district want to start out that discussion?
Well, as I already have summarized, I basically am in agreement with staff's revised findings in Exhibit B regarding the requirement for permits. I don't think that this project falls under the exemption F and or any other exemption, so I do believe it requires a grading permit. I felt that way last time, and apparently because it is a grading permit is within the appealable coastal zone, it also requires a minor use permit automatically, so therefore I'm comfortable with finding in Exhibit C and staff's analysis. But I understand that there's people who have questions and probably want to discuss things, so I'm happy to listen.
So with that, who's next? I don't see any lights on.
I'm not prepared yet, so if you want to go ahead.
Commissioner O'Grady, you want to start off the response?
Sure. What work are we doing here? What are we thinking about doing? And I'm looking at the document prepared, looks like by Canon Engineers, Conceptual Design of Pirates Cove Waterline Improvements. And it looks like they're extending, well, I see. I'm not making a distinction. What I started my remarks out was by saying, what is the work that we are doing here? Okay, whether it's in the coastal zone or in Chicago or Kansas City or other places where I've lived, you're putting a water line in a street. And to require a land use permit for that, to me, is nonsensical and unreasonable. And you have to ask yourself, what are the consequences if the land use permit is denied? I mean, so you can't get the water to the site.
Let's think through that, though. Why would the land use permit be not denied? Because there are environmental impacts of some sort. But
no, the likely thing. No, I take exception. The likely thing is that the Coastal Commission might say that the USL has to be extended and have absolutely nothing to do with an environmental issue. So I'm trying to get real here and get practical that this is a water main extension to a few houses. It's in a street. And to require land use permits anywhere, to me, is unreasonable and unrealistic.
Okay, but so could we take that a little farther?
Sure.
The water lines are serving potentially residences. I don't know because I haven't looked at a project yet. And you're looking at a one-page schematic that we just received in the hearing, correct?
Right, sure.
So just for the record, I don't know what project we're talking about, and I haven't looked at this one-page schematic that we just received. But I would suggest that that's part of our problem here and why we're in this dilemma, because we don't have a project before us. We don't know exactly what these water lines are, where they're going to go. We've just received some 8.5 by 11 piece of paper. And the water lines are just the drop in the bucket of some kind of project for a house or houses that is not before us. And we don't know what all of the impacts are going to be. So you might say, oh, maybe it's a 4-inch water line under a road, and that doesn't have too many impacts. But that's part of a whole construction of some other project that may well have impacts. It's just one of many. And that's part of the problem is the uncertainty here, that we're making assumptions for some project with impacts that may or may not be that we don't know yet. I mean, it may not have impacts, but it may have impacts, this whole project. I don't know how we can know that or not know that yet.
This is not unusual in my brief experience on this commission not to have complete information about a development. We have conceptual design of water lines going down a street to a future to a housing development. So, I don't know how you deal with impacts beyond the scope of what we're being asked here to decide. And if that's the case, I think we'll be here forever.
Madam Chair, just on that point, I thought that, you know, we got a lot of information in the last hearing, and my head was spinning. I got a little more grounded here today. But I thought we established in the last hearing, and maybe Mr. Marshall can clarify this for us, that an encroachment permit would be required to determine the issue that you're concerned about, and that environmental review could potentially be part of that encroachment permit. If Mr. Marshall could clarify that.
Yeah, Glenn Marshall, County Public Works. An encroachment permit would be required of this project by the applicant, and they'd be responsible for obtaining all the necessary permits. And that one of the necessary permits might be a coastal development permit. And that's what our concern is. If your commission proceeds with allowing them not to get that, then we've circumvented the process that even your own county is required to do. You're giving the county, if this were a county project, or if we had a county project in the coastal zone that was putting in the water, we would be responsible for at least determining if we were required to get a coastal development permit.
So just to clarify that response, so if we did not require a land use permit today, i.e. a grading permit, the applicant would still be required to submit for an encroachment permit. Under that encroachment permit review process, the county, the public works, could require a coastal development permit?
Well, that's where it gets sketchy, because your board would be circumventing, your commission might circumvent the process that's in place. And maybe Mr. Orton would have to respond.
Well, I think typically when an encroachment permit is issued, that type of condition is not imposed. That's not to say it could not be imposed. There would be environmental review of a project like that. I think that an answer to Commissioner O'Grady's question about the land use permit that he raised, usually you'd have a subdivision or a minor use permit for a house coming in, and in connection with it would be
a specific project for some of the commissioners to look at and for staff to look at. And then there would be the normal process that you just spoke about. And then if there were some issue at that point about what permits need to be, I mean, you all would be on record as saying this is what you have to get for this particular development. And if the applicant had a problem with that, we'd be back here just dealing with an appeal on the water line. So that's what I conclude based on the last two conversations.
Well, the only thing I would add is that the applicant has asked for an interpretation of the ordinance, and the director has given his interpretation. That's being appealed, and there are the two issues that are raised. And so I think you should address both of the issues, although I agree with you. There is a permit application on file for the house, and it's going through the environmental review process at this point.
Exactly. So there would be more information available once that process takes place, and then the director or whoever it is can take a second look at it and say, "Yeah, we're going to stick with our prior decision that this encroachment." Ordinance or permit would lead to coastal development and land use, and here we are back again. But we don't know that for sure. Is that right, or is that just a given? And we're wasting time if we back up.
Well, I think you're having me speculate on how the department would process it. You know, one thing that may happen is it may come with a recommendation for denial. But without an environmental review. But I think you should be addressing the two issues that have been raised in the interpretation request. I would have a concern that if you didn't address the second issue one way or the other.
But I feel like the commission, and I don't mean this in a pejorative way as being intentional, but I feel like we're being set up. Because we're we're being asked to comment on a process that could have two outcomes, which is incomplete, and which, for which, if we decide one either way, we could be criticized for not letting the process unfold. In fact, Commissioner Wyatt is already saying that, in effect, that this is premature for us to be making such a decision on this second item because we don't know impacts, because we don't have a specific project to look at. And she's got a point. And that's why I'm real uncomfortable about going beyond part one about the decision on the USL until the process has a chance to proceed as far as it can go, and that information be given to us to make a decision at that point.
I'm confused what you guys are talking about, encroachment permits and not about a grading permit. Maybe they're the same thing and I'm just completely like lost or what?
No, they're not. They're not. Go ahead.
So why, I don't really get why you're talking about an encroachment permit and I'm talking about a grading permit and no one's talking about what the difference is. Why we're talking about both of them.
Sure. Glenn Marshall, County Public Works. An encroachment permit gives, if it's a discretionary permit by staff and it allows a private party to, or a public utility, to work within the public maintained right-of-way.
Right, okay.
And that's a requirement if you're going to work in the right-of-way. So this project would trigger an encroachment permit from Public Works. The grading permit, I think, that came up was an exemption they were asking for, saying that they weren't, maybe Ryan at best respond to this one.
Well, the grading permit is separate, and it's out of Title 23, and the encroachment permit's out of, I don't know the title that the Public Works encroachment permits.
Oh, that's all under the Streets and Highways Code. That's a different code.
So, yes, they are separate permits.
So no one's asked us about the encroachment permit specifically at all.
Yeah, we're not waiting.
You're just talking about the grading permit, and you're just saying, well, yeah, if you're working in the public right of way, eventually you're going to have to deal with the encroachment permit issue. But we're not. That's not really actually in front of us.
I think the link here is they're asking for an exemption for having to have a development permit. The grading permit would have triggered a development permit, and Public Works is saying, before we issue you an encroachment permit, you have to have all your other permits in place.
Okay.
And we're saying Public Works' position is a project like this may require a development permit, but they should go through the process that helps. And they're asking to be exempted from that process, unlike what would normally happen.
Okay.
So that's the question on the second part of this before us, is that the appellant is asking for that exemption from the...
One procedural suggestion I can make is that if you're not comfortable making a decision on the second issue today, to continue that issue until after you've had an opportunity to review the MUP application that has been submitted by Mr. McCarthy and Mr. Watson for parcel number 2. So it's not as though you've got to decide the second issue today if you want to continue it. Until you've had an opportunity to obtain more information about the development of Parcel 2.
Well, with a follow-up on that, would the minor use permit for Parcel 2 include this water line? Would you amend the application then to include it?
I don't represent the owner of Parcel 2. Mr. Watson is the representative for the owner of Parcel 2.
I think that would solve a lot of our problems if you'd be willing to do that.
Dave Watson again for Mr. McCarthy. A split personality here. We understand the point, and I think under the circumstances, whether it's an encroachment permit or whether it's a minor use permit additive to the house that's pending, if you want us to bring that back as a part of the processing of the house and to consider the environmental consequences, I think that can be easily done as a part of the pending use permit, hopefully filed use permit, that Ryan referred to. I don't want you to make a decision that you think opens the door to bad precedent. That's not what we're asking for today. We were attempting to distinguish the issue of land use permit from construction permit, but I understand the overwhelming concerns that exist, both with your staff, you, and with the commission potentially weighing in. So
If the commission prefers to defer on the second point, I think the most expeditious way to deal with this would be to either present directly to you the documentation associated with the pending encroachment permit, or make it a part of the use permit for the house and just bring the whole thing forward. Now, that's a pending minor use permit application, which you may actually be dealt with at a staff level, and you may never see us again.
Okay,
but, you're okay with me. I don't know about right. Can't speak for everybody else.
I don't know if those things passing that off is just an option here, exactly, although that might be...
It's just that my head is hurting from all this.
Okay.
Honestly, mine too.
Thank you for that. Okay, so... good try, Commissioner White. Like it. Like it. That's creative. More thoughts on the matter? Does that lead you anywhere? I would propose... I don't think we can just kind of pawn it off. I think putting off a decision and not making it would be nice, but I think the question is before us, and unless it comes back in the form of a CDP request or application.
Well, it's not putting it off. It's addressing exactly your concerns about lack of information. I mean, it's a major
but
concern.
But it won't even come back to us
maybe,
to address
maybe
those. So that's the issue. If it comes back to us folded into that application, then that does address some of my concerns. But if it would be handled as at Moffitt staff level.
If I may, sorry to interrupt. As Mr. Flynn noted, if the commission would like to continue the second item, if they are agreeable, as this is their appeal, if they are agreeable in continuing the second item, and Mr. Watson's team is okay with using our existing MUF, they don't need to apply for another one. We can amend this current one and then bring it back. We do have the ability of bringing a minor use permit to the Planning Commission if you would like to see it in that forum. So we do have the ability to bring that minor use permit for the house before your commission with the water line, and we don't need a new permit application or anything, just an amendment to our existing one. So we could do that as well.
Okay, I'm just thinking, though, how that gets out of the issue or the requirement then for the CDP with the MUP.
It is a CDP.
So it does become, it automatically does become a CDP.
That was my clarification.
So it's the same, it's a MUP and CDP. So we would be hearing it then with wrapped into the bigger project.
Well, that
probably addresses my concerns there. So.
Madam Chair, I might add that given the depth of discussion that you've had, and if the water line does get wrapped into the minor use permit for the house, we would elevate that and bring it back to your commission.
Okay. Well, that solves my concern on the second count, because it's a theoretical concern. We don't know what we're looking at. We're looking at something, but nothing. We don't know. So
well, we're not voting to preclude it from the Coastal Commission either, and that I think is the main point.
Okay,
am I getting that right?
So. That's true as well.
So staff would be moderately comfortable then with willing to bring that back?
So.
I don't want to go there again.
Oh, I'm out there. Okay.
Well, it sounds like we're headed the most prudent direction here, and so I'm willing to go along with that route.
Okay, and it's looking like people are comfortable with that.
Yeah, and I appreciate the applicant's participation in this process and their understanding of what we're all up against here. So thank you.
Yes, I second that, too.
Okay, so it sounds like there was enough votes on the first part, and that's the second part. So what else, Commissioner O'Grady?
Yes, I briefly mentioned that one of the reasons I supported or found that Works Policy 1 was satisfied in this case is because I felt like the use of off-site water was an environmentally superior alternative to drilling wells on site. But we have to make some findings to that effect, and staff has presented some suggested findings, and it does mention the use the point about off-site water being environmentally superior to on-site water, because the drilling of wells on the coast would create more environmental impacts due to the lack of a groundwater resource, distribution and potential grading, etc. The finding is incomplete from my perspective, in that it doesn't say that, in fact, that is based on the prohibition of on-site wells in the future, in order to make that finding. It's supposed to be a permanent finding, right, not just a temporary one. So I'm looking for words to make that permanent and not just temporary until the first well is drilled, which I don't want to happen, or I don't know how I can make the finding. So, but that's where I guess the law comes in, and am I asking for something here that can't be done, or can it?
But you're making a finding and interpreting the ordinance. However, the rights of property owners to use underlying water is set forth in state law, and I don't think you have the authority to condition that it not be used that way, and I don't think our ordinance prohibits individuals from drilling a well. So
even if water is delivered to the development, it's still there's rights that there can't be an agreement.
Well, if you're within the boundaries of a district, our ordinances require that the district provide water, and it's like the Cambridge Community Service District, the Evola Beach Community Service District, that's a requirement of our ordinance. But if you're outside those districts, I think you have the right to drill a well. And
okay, maybe what I'm asking here to accomplish in a finding is inappropriate, wrong time, wrong place. But it may be the right time and the right place to revisit this issue when we get the MUP back.
No, I would just say you've caught right on here on this finding. None of these findings. I don't think we can make these findings, and we're looking at this one now. That's exactly the problem. That how I think you're totally right. We cannot make this finding because we don't have information, and we're not authorized to limit on-site water use.
Well, I just asked for the information, and this is not a condition. It's a finding, and the finding has to be made based on the best available information, not on perfect information.
But we don't have any information, and as you've just found, we don't have the authority to limit on-site use. So we could be bringing water from off-site through a pipe that has to run a long distance that we don't know much about the impacts of, and they could still drill wells on the site.
Well, but again, the alternative is to take the water away, to deny the water, and then it's a self-fulfilling prophecy. You're going to get the wells. And I don't want to do that. So I guess I'll just allay my concerns temporarily until the MUP comes back and we go through the normal process that we just got finished speaking about, and then revisit that subject at that time and see what we can do.
Well, may I suggest then we should revisit this first part too? Because I would again suggest, as you have just noted, you can't make this finding without precluding the use of the on-site well use. Because we don't have the information to make this finding either. Again, there could be huge impacts from wheeling this water around and bringing it from somewhere else versus other options.
But it's first. And then the second part would be this idea about environmentally superior. And I don't really think you have to use the word would. You just need to use the word could. It could be in this be environmentally superior. That's enough for me on this one at this level. And then you're not making a finding that is absolutely tied to a factual discussion of environmental superior. Then you go back to the original discussion we had about common sense. That common sense tells us that
so there's our finding. Yes. We have no facts before
us.
We have
a lot of facts that we know in terms of about water and about water on coastal zones and water close to the ocean and water and bluffs and drilling on bluffs and all those kinds of things. We do have that information. I mean, that's, again,
We go back to what to our original point, where four of us agree, one of us disagrees, about how technical you want to get about following the intent of this policy. The policy is a good one. It talks about availability of resource capacity, and it is a good one. But when you're talking about drilling wells on a bluff only a few hundred feet from the ocean, hello? So why go to all that trouble of going there when you kind of know where you're going to be? That's all we're saying. And I think that the intent is met. And I think that the reasons that Commissioner O'Grady has outlined are good ones. So I'm not needing to go to the use of the word would. I'm fine with could. So how I would do this would be right to take this sentence, CSA 12 is able to monitor water resources, and put that first. It started off with a different phrase.
Well, you said the intent of Public Works Policy 1 is met because
yes.
CSA 12 is able, and that more clearly conveys your
right.
intent.
That's
it,
yes.
And Commissioner, I believe all
so
of
that's
you
what
were...
I say. The intent of Policy 1 is met.
Is met because CSA 12
yes.
is able to blah, 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 blah.
Yes.
Well,
that's one thing. And then the second part is approval of the delivery of CSA 12 could, in this particular case, be environmentally superior to the use of on-site water. And that's all I'm going to get to. And then because drilling of wells on the coast could. You know, if you want to use the word could very likely, you know, but could create environmental effects due to that. Da, da, da. So that's where I'm stopping here.
I really like your wording and rewording of this.
Thank you. And I know that Commissioner White believed that this is not, it has a public works aspect to it. I do not agree with that at all, and I would not be happy about putting something like that in the findings.
Goes to the water line, which we're
yeah,
referring to the line use permit. So.
So anyway, so then I would just I don't know about B and what that's there for, but anyway, then take out number C because we're not going to deal with the
BSD.
Yeah.
Actually,
you need something about.
We have some wording for C.
Okay.
That talks about.
Okay.
I don't read that to you.
Yeah, because I was going to say we have to completely do something about C.
All I was trying to interject is that Mr. Orton asked a question of the applicant which findings they would prefer us to consider, and I didn't know if the commission wants to consider any of the applicant's findings or not. Because when you started reading your first part of finding A, it somewhat mirrors some of the findings the applicant submitted.
I think they changed the word would to could, and I think that's the kind of the key thing. I don't really think everything else is gravy. But I wanted to put the part about they took the whole thing about CSA 12, but I wanted to put the part about the intent of the policy because I think that to me is very important, and I just think that changing the would to could makes much more sense in terms of what kind of facts we do or do not have in front of us today and last time. Okay, so here's number C, construction insulation. Do you want to go ahead and read that for us, for the record, just so it's out there? I can't.
Yes. Construction and installation of improvements for water delivery, i.e. trenching, installation of pipes and pump stations, to the site should be considered as part of the minor use permits for construction of residences on the property.
Yeah, just get rid of the apostrophe after and permit.
There's
a... Or a parenthesis, because there's...
There could be more than one minor use permit.
Okay.
Okay. So we have a new A, leaving B, and a new C here. So are you comfortable with that, Commissioner Christensen?
Yes.
Or are you working on this?
Okay. No, I'm good.
Changes?
I have just,
other
just,
changes,
just
suggestions?
Some slight changes.
Okay.
That some of which I took from the applicant's suggestions. Okay, let's start with A. The intent of Public Works Policy 1 is met, blah, da, 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 da. Okay, after the word bluff, period, approval of the, I think
we could just scratch approval of the and just capitalize D for delivery and just say delivery of CSA 12 water, and I think we already changed would to could, did we? Could, yes, we did change that. And then we took out little down below, I guess we did, yeah. Okay, well, I guess that's my only change is that we don't need approval of that. We just should say we find the delivery of the water.
I have one suggestion right in there also. Where we say what little groundwater there is, that's a relatively definitive statement. How about what little groundwater there may be?
Oh, supposed to come out.
Get rid of is and add?
We took little out.
We thought we did.
And then what groundwater there is or there may be?
Maybe.
I'd be more comfortable with maybe.
Okay, so are other commissioners comfortable with that?
Yes.
Let's just go back. There's an extra which in that first sentence. The intent of PW1 is met because CSA 12 is able to monitor water resources within their sphere, which from a resource capacity perspective, nick
yes.
that second which.
Yeah, there we go. Good catch.
Is superior to taking what groundwater there may be on the bluff. Delivery of CSA water to the project could, in this particular case, be environmentally superior to the use of on-site water. Okay, comfortable with that wording?
Sounds good.
For that?
And B, could I just suggest a minor modification? Okay, allowing the Ontario Ridge properties to receive public water from CSA 12 does not, and then I would like to add, does not require and does not include the extension of any urban services line.
Is
that okay with
that's fine.
Fellow commissioners? Okay.
What was
thank
the second
you.
Part of that? I'm sorry. Does not?
That was good. You said it does not require.
He had the extension of any.
He made a key
urban
change.
Services.
He said
he
any urban
any.
Service line.
There's the word thought in front of urban.
Oh, okay.
I changed that to any.
There's one other suggestion I would make, if I could go back to finding A. The reference is to CSA monitoring water resources within their sphere. Technically speaking, from reviewing the LAFCO documents, that area is actually their service area. It's within their boundaries now. So I would suggest changing the word to sphere to their service area.
Sounds good to me.
Okay.
Yeah, that falls more in line with the USL, so I like the term.
Okay,
so we've changed B then. Receive public water does not include extension of any USL. Okay, everybody is comfortable with that? Change to B also? Okay, and C, are comfortable with that or any changes to C? Okay, so I'm seeing nodding of agreement there on the findings then for that first part of the question. So do I hear a motion?
Yes. I'm going to go ahead and make a motion, and please, County Council, step in if I'm leaving something out, since we don't actually have one written here for us. I'm going to move that we uphold the appeal of the Planning Director determination of San Miguelito Partners, item number DTM2010-0001, based on the revised findings contained in Exhibit A.
I just wanted to bring your attention on page 2. There's recommended actions where you could just refer to item number 1 and not item number 2. And what you just stated, I was concerned about how you were addressing item number 2.
Well, item number 2 is addressed by, would be addressed by C.
Well, no, actually, because we were going to act on item 2 within this. Oh, I see, addressing it here in these findings.
But their appeal of the interpretation was on both issues, and by referencing the appeal, I was concerned that you may be going to. I understand the finding of C addresses the issue, but just wanted to make it clear.
Do you want some extension of the motion then? Is that what you're looking for, that will be?
Well, I was wondering if maybe you did the recommended action.
Item number DTM 2010-001, based on the revised findings in contained in Exhibit A. That's good? Is that better?
Well, I think it's fine. I guess a partial upholding is also a partial denial, so I don't know whether there should be two separate motions.
We should just split this up.
Okay.
So there's not any...
Well, I can say, how about this? I'll just be more specific. We are addressing the appeal of the planning department's planning director's determination of the San Miguel Ito Partners item number DTM 2010-0001 by upholding the appeal with regard to issue 1 based on the revised findings contained in Exhibit A, and deferring a decision on item 2 based on the revised findings contained in Exhibit A. How's that? Okay, can I get
that
a second?
That works for me.
Okay, so we have a motion and a second. With that, then, let's call for the vote.
Commissioner Christensen?
Aye.
Commissioner Wyatt?
Yes.
Commissioner O'Grady?
Yes.
Commissioner Malskow?
Yes.
Chairperson Wyatt?
No.
Okay,
so with that, then, we have upheld the appeal on a 4-1 vote. And we will see the second part come back to us with that MEPCDP at a later date. Thank you to the applicants and staff for the work on that. And so at 11:39, we have one more item on the agenda for today. So while staff is coming up on that, let's just discuss housekeeping timing. It's now 20 minutes to noon. And does staff have an estimated time expectation for this item?
It will be up to your commission how much time you want to spend on it. It's a study session. We would probably need at least an hour to talk about the background.
Okay, and so before we get into it, that's why I wanted to take this opportunity now. It's 20 minutes to noon. So are commissioners comfortable then hearing this item and then deferring lunch to some point, maybe 1 o'clock, and if we're still going, we could recalculate then, or would commissioners like to take lunch at noon, or what are the needs?
I would recommend that you take lunch at 12:15 and then come back at 1:30, and if you wrap up by 3, that's the best in terms of the other considerations we've talked about in the past.
Get a break then.
Yeah, because otherwise I don't think you would finish before we would kick into extra costs.
Overtime for lunch.
Yeah, and
I'm not in agreement on that.
Yeah, I don't think we're going to get
Could I ask what is the cutoff before the extra costs? Is it 1:15 or 1 o'clock?
If you do end up taking a lunch, you need to take it by 12:15. In terms of what it cost, I think we determined that if you didn't finish by 1:30, it costs more than what taking a lunch and then finishing by 3 o'clock would be. Unfortunately, I just shut down my computer and I can't get back into that memo that I prepared for you on those costs. Maybe Dan has a copy there.
I have the copy, but
I think the bottom line says.
So while there's a pause here, if anyone isn't clear, we have some overtime cost constraints for the videoing of the meetings. So that's one of the factors here to weigh at this point, in addition to schedules of staff and commissioners here, as far as whether it's more prudent to go through lunch or take the lunch break.
Well, we did get some new information submitted this morning, but on the other hand, we're not taking action today. So I don't know how important it would be for us to review this information before the...
Well, you might want to consider just going to lunch now to have more time
right.
to review that information.
That was the third option, that we just
and
take
lunch
now and
come back a little
come
sooner
back
if you
to
want.
It. Yeah, so actually, if that would work for people, maybe what we should do is go a little early and come back early. Do we have that flexibility in with the overtime constraints?
Yeah,
could we come back at 12:30?
You would still have an hour and a half.
Oh, only that early.
All right. I'm open to suggestions if anyone has any concerns.
Actually,
I could go either way.
Really
so.
Wrongly obligated to do it.
Right. So
yeah,
I would propose if we could go now, we could just do a straight shot with this after lunch rather than opening for a few minutes and closing. So it's now 11:42, so if we would have the option to drop lunch to an hour, we could reconvene at 12:45.
I'll second that motion.
Okay. Yes. And so all in favor of that?
Except I don't know whether we want him to stay.
Well, maybe we could merge him in when he arrives.
All right.
I think a few of us have been confused on this short lunch and the return time. And
let's talk about the groundwater basin. The purpose of the study session is to give your commission and the public a little bit of background on this issue. Staff is not presenting the resource capacity study itself. It wasn't even part of your September 9th agenda packet, but you'll notice that it is in your September 23rd packet for for the public hearing on this item. We wanted to focus on background information. A lot of the information of the data that goes into the RCS needs to be discussed today. So that's what our purpose was in having this study session. We'll start with the screen on the slide on the screen. The slide on the screen is the groundwater basin boundary. The boundary is in that light color with the red dots on it. It's a very oddly shaped basin down at the south end. You'll notice it goes up and down the various canyons south of Garden Farms and the Tascadero, reaches into some of those surface creeks and streams. It goes way up into Monterey County. You'll notice off the edge of the earth there at the top where the dragons are. The west side is bounded generally by the freeway and the river, a little bit to the west of where the freeway is, the 101 is, from Atascadero up to Paso. And then it cuts over to the northwest, north of Paso. It's a large basin. Matter of fact, we even have the acreage here somewhere. It was big. It's 500,000 acres or somewhere around there. It's also a large basin, not just in area, but in depth. The Department of Water Resources has estimated that it holds upwards of 30 million acre-feet of water. Not all of it recoverable, of course. One of the other aspects of this map, which is interesting, which I wanted to point out to you, is the red lines on the map. You'll notice all the red lines break the groundwater basin up into what we can call sub-areas or perhaps planning areas. They're done not for any hydrogeology reason, but they're done for water planning reasons. And you'll see the names. Like up here is the South Gavilan. Here's the Bradley sub-area. The Shandon sub-area is here. Creston sub-area is here. And then the Estrella sub-area is this large one that includes the city and a lot of the land to the east and west of the city of Paso Robles. There is one sub-basin in the Paso Robles groundwater basin, and that's the Atascadero sub-basin. This is this long, narrow area right in here along the river, just east of the river, east of the city of Atascadero. And it is a sub-basin. It has been identified by the hydrogeology work that's been going on in the basin since about the year 2000 as a distinct sub-basin. A sub-basin merely is a part of the basin that reacts differently than the rest of the basin. There might be a boundary between the sub-basin and the rest of the basin that water perhaps doesn't move through easily. In some geologic fashion, it's different from the rest of the basin. It operates a bit different than the basin, and it reacts to inflows and outflows a bit differently. There is some controversy, of course, over whether this is an actual sub-basin or not. We're not going to get into that today. It's a question for the hydrogeologists probably in the future, though.
Chairperson Wyatt, excuse me, Mr. Caruso, but if certain slides are on the screen and we have questions, can we ask them then, or what are we supposed to hold our...
Let's ask Mr. Caruso, are you more comfortable having us just interject, or probably better to hold them to the end?
Actually, I was going to say it would be perfectly okay to interject questions as they come up.
Yeah,
so if you're comfortable with that,
very
then
comfortable.
Just go ahead.
Okay, thanks. The only thing, there seems to be an island of blue, light blue and red dots
just to the right of and above where it says Atascadero. What is that?
Not sure.
Okay.
It's the edge of the Atascadero subbasin. It's the eastern portion of the subbasin. We're not seeing the outlet. It could be a stream that comes down a canyon, and because of the lines are so thick, you don't see the outlet at the south end of that. It looks like a perfect circle.
Okay,
I thought
it might mean there's no water within the boundaries of that. But
I don't believe that's what it means.
Okay,
I believe we just
right.
can't see the southern
okay.
outlet of that.
All right, thank you.
So let's talk a bit about resource capacity studies and what they are. A resource capacity study is part of the resource management system. The resource management system is described in what those levels of severity are in a minute. However, more importantly, and perhaps most importantly, a resource capacity study will have action recommendations in response to those levels of severity. If, for instance, the resource capacity study establishes that you have a level of severity 3, perhaps because your groundwater basin is an overdraft or approaching overdraft, those action recommendations should be commensurate with the scope of the problem. And they are also, as I said, the heart of the resource capacity study, because they're going to provide for a framework of what are we going to do about this water supply problem over the next X number of years. So your commission looks at the RCS and discusses it in 2 weeks at the public hearing, takes testimony on it. It would be best to focus most of our attention and our efforts on those action recommendations. We've also had a long history of work, of hydrogeologic work in the basin. And we can trace most of that work back to, actually, this book right here, which is the FUGRO, what's called the Final Report on the Paso Robles Groundwater Basin, August 2002, that was published. It contains most of the information that we still use to describe the physical characteristics of the basin. One of the outgrowths of that 2002 report was FUGRO's final report in February 2005 that did most of the modeling of the basin. Your commission might know that when you're trying to figure out how a basin is operating, what's happening to all the inflows and the outflows, you basically do a mathematical model. And that model will tell you for all of your inputs, here are your outputs. Models are made by people. Of course, they're not perfect. We do have a recommendation here we'll talk about probably in 2 weeks at the hearing, that there's still work to do. The model needs to be upgraded, updated. It was done. It's already 5 years old. There's a lot more information. So modeling of groundwater basins is important because it tells you how the basin is reacting to various inputs. Then in 2007, under Todd Engineers, there was an update on that information from the FUGRO reports. That was done jointly by the city of Paso Robles and the county. Todd Engineers did a pumping update in May 2009, where all of the outflows, all of the people, all the different sectors that are pumping water out of the basin, agriculture, the rural residential pumpers, the cities that pump out of the basin, all of those, all that pumping was quantified and put into this pumping update in May 2009. And now finally we have FUGRO 2010, which is an update of the original 2005 water balance. So as you can see, we've done quite a bit of work since 2002, quite a bit of work since 2007 when the board directed preparation of this RCS. So we've been gaining knowledge of the basin, we've been gaining knowledge of how good our assumptions are, and we've been zeroing in on the data. And here's a little bit of a history. We completed what was called phase one of the RCS in 2008. It was decided that, however, additional data was needed. A lot of the information we were dealing with was getting old. It was at least 3 to 5 years old at that point. So the county and the city of Paso, in cooperation with one another, hired Todd Engineers to do that 2009 pumping update. They used 2006 data, because your data for these studies is always lagging behind the year that's done. Back in 08, when this study was first started, when the pumping evaluation was first started, 2006 was the best data that we had.
So as you can see, we're already 4 years lagging behind. We then completed phase two in 2009, phase two of the RCS, brought it to the Planning Commission in June of 2009, and the commission decided to tell us to go away, get some more information. The county, the city of Paso, the other cities and water purveyors jointly funded the FUGRO 2010 Water Balance Review and Update, which you have copies of now. And then the last thing that was done by the city of Paso Robles hired Gus Yates, who is a retired hydrogeologist, and he has just conducted a peer review of all of the work that's been done in the basin since 2002. So as I said, the body of work is getting larger and larger for this basin. And also, as the body of work gets larger, our knowledge and our confidence in the data gets better and better. So where are we at outflow-wise? This handy little table takes a look at the pumping sectors down the left-hand side and the years over the top. It tells us just what type of outflows from each pumping sector we've been experiencing in this basin. And we can see since 1997 how those outflows have grown, approximately 74,000 acre-feet in 97, all the way it's going. Basin levels will drop because of drought conditions. However, over a long period of time, all of that's going to even out in the end. And if you don't pump more than 97,700 acre-feet a year, you're going to remain your basin will not go into overdraft. That's the idea.
Excuse me, Mr. Crusoe, while we're on this chart in front of us, we show these estimates of pumping. Are they backed up by specific data from the purveyors?
And in fact, the only sector here where we are pretty sure we know we have pumping information is the urban sector. Because all the urban pumpers must keep records and report to DWR.
So the agriculture being the largest, how big of a degree of uncertainty is there? I mean, what could that vary?
Well, that's the scary part. And we'll talk about this in a little while, a bit more in depth, but yes, I've got the next slide. Let's go on to the next slide. We're going to get into that exact question. Don't be frightened. All right? Don't be frightened. This isn't as difficult. This table is not as difficult as you think. This is you've heard the term water balance. Well, here it is. And let's go through this. It takes a while to understand what's going on, but once you see what's going on, it's a pretty simple idea. We're going to divide this table right here. See this line right here? And so we're going to talk to the right of this line. All of these numbers here, all of these numbers are outflows from the basin. So basically, and these numbers on this side are inflows. That's what a water balance is. Let's count all of the inflows into the basin, and let's figure out what the outflows are. And we can find out if our basin is equilibrium, or if we have indeed more outflows than inflows. Remember, you don't want more outflows than inflows. So on this side, on the right-hand side, we're going to start right here. We have a constant. The subsurface outflow in acre-feet is always a constant. And I don't know how they figure that out, but they do. The next five are the pumping sectors and how much water we estimate each of those pumping sectors is taking out of the basin in a given year. Speaking first of the agricultural groundwater pumping, these numbers are based on several things. The first is all the different types of agriculture in the basin. Vineyards are the biggest type of agriculture, the biggest crop, but there are other crops also. We have those numbers, that acreage. We have an approximate acreage of all of those crops. We also have an approximate water duty for those crops. How many acre-feet of water per acre does it take to get through a growing season for alfalfa, for row crops, for grapes, for all of the other types of agriculture that are in the basin? Once we know that, it's simply a mathematical formula to figure out how much water that sector is pumping out of the basin to support that acreage of that particular crop. These are estimates.
You know, while you're on that specific point, I believe I read in the FUGRO report that grapes, for example, take 1.25 acre-feet per year. So 15 inches of standing water. I mean, my gosh, it's like we're growing rice. I mean, is that accurate?
Sure, as far as it's accurate. It's as accurate as we're going to get. And it's more accurate than anything else that's out there. It's pretty self-serving, but if anybody comes up to your commission and says, oh, these numbers are wrong, grapes don't use that much water, ask them for their data, because there isn't anything else out there right now. This is it. This is more than enough for decision makers to move forward on this resource capacity study.
Mr. Caruso and Commissioner White, I believe the Wine Country Alliance has started collecting data from growers so that as we go forward, I think.
Sure. Let's be a little bit more. Sure. Let's correct that a little bit. And it's the UC Extension is conducting the study in cooperation with a lot of the North County growers and the Wine Country Alliance. However, it is the UC Extension that's conducting the 3-year study of water use in the vineyards, and hopefully we'll get some numbers out of that. We're going to be talking in a minute why we have so much confidence in these numbers when others do not. However, I do want to emphasize once again, there isn't anything else out there. So if you don't believe the numbers, it's too bad, because that's all we've got. Oops. Someone's talking at me. Shut up.
I'll just say that while Mr. Caruso is checking his phone, that for those that are maybe struggling trying to read the fine numbers on the overhead, this is a part of the report. It's in the study, and this is available online.
They also can. Everyone can read it. We checked.
Okay, good.
I made sure we checked. A typical rural residence in North County uses every year. Just in the like in the ag water duties, there's a lot of controversy over that rural residential water duty. A lot of people think that's too high, 1.7 acre feet. That's way too high. Once again, ask them, well, how much water do you think that? How much water does your study say they use? There isn't anything out there. And we realize it's highly variable. You could have a 10 acre parcel with an old mobile home on it that's using hardly any water right next door to a 10 acre parcel that has a little hobby vineyard on it or olives. Or a large, i.e. 5,000 to 6,000 square foot house with substantial landscaping that might be using 2 acre feet a year. So you might have this one parcel that's using 0.3 acre feet, another parcel that's using 3 or 4 acre feet a year, depending on their landscaping practices, depending on their hobby agriculture, depending on size of the landscaped area, depending on a lot of things. So when you put all that into your mix master, you come out with 1.7 acre feet a year.
Mr. Caruso, sorry to interrupt again, but on those points, we have established urban pumping records metered. Do we have established urban wastewater discharge metered?
Yes, and we'll get that to that in a minute on the outflow side.
And the follow-up question on that on the outflow is that I saw where the septic outflow is calculated at 50%. Is that of the 1.7 or the 1? I also saw 1 acre feet per rural residential.
Yeah, we'll get that.
We're going to get there. Okay.
Just a second.
Maybe it's premature to ask the question then, but just so you can be thinking about it, is the urban wastewater discharge also calculated at a 50%, or is it, or does the metered numbers of the discharge equate to 50% of the metered?
Right. And when we go through it, you'll see that what we do is we subtract the entire number because it's all outflow, but on the left side of the table, we put back the net, because part of that, your house goes through, your water goes through your house, out your septic system, so you pump that water up, and that 100% of that water is in the inflow side, but then a certain amount, and it's about 50%, goes back through your leach field, so your net pumping is actually 50% of that number.
Yes.
So 100% of that number shows up on the inflow side.
So the 1.7 is the gross number. The net number is 50%.
And then the left side of the table will net that out. We'll take away the 50%.
But the other question I'm asking is, does that hold true since we have metered urban wastewater discharge? Does that hold true to being around 50% of the pumping?
Well, I don't know. We have it right here. Urban, it's almost 5,000 on the 4,961 acre feet on the outflow side for urban wastewater discharge. And urban groundwater pumping is 14.7, so no, it's about 30%.
And how do you explain for that differential? Would it be in more urban landscaping?
Sure, less water going through your sewer system into your wastewater treatment plant.
whereas on more rural areas, there's maybe less landscape.
I guess almost everything goes. Everything that uses.
Yes.
I guess that's the idea.
Okay, thank you.
Then moving on to the inflows, small commercial groundwater. That's just that those are the small commercial uses out there. There's restaurants. There's things like the old youth authority. There's a whole list in Todd 2009 of all of those small commercial groundwater. And these numbers are we're unsure of also. However, they're small numbers. If you go back to here, you'll notice that, you know, with small commercial, 2,300 acre feet, well, you know, if we're off a little bit, they don't add up to large discrepancies. It also needs some work, though. For instance, the wineries are in here, the small commercial, and we don't have a good handle on exact winery use, but we're getting there. So let's go over to the other side. Let's go over to the left-hand side of this table, and you'll see that we have a water year, and what we've done with the water years is from 2010 to 2025, and this came out of FUGRO's 2010 water balance update. We just took those last 15 years from 2009 back 15 years and flopped them into the future. Because remember, all of the inflows in the basin are based on one thing and one thing only, and that's rainfall. So we took the last 15 years of rainfall and then stuck them into this 2010 to 2025. So the exact last 15 years of rainfall pattern is what we use for the next 15 years. It was decided that this was adequate because those last 15 years looked to be just about average over the past 35 some odd years that they use for rainfall averages. So it seemed to be okay to use those exact numbers. And you need these, you need that rainfall information to fill in these inflow areas. You'll notice that, like in 2011, because this mirrors the pattern, this is a big rainfall year. Look at the second, the third box, precipitation percolation, 339,592 acre feet. Some of it actually leaches all the way back into the groundwater basin. That's a truck. That's a long distance. It could be a couple of hundred feet. It's still a certain amount that's going to make it down there. This irrigation return flow column shows that amount of irrigation water from this outflow. These outflow boxes, this is what comes back in. And as Commissioner White was pointing out, that is a small number. Same thing with urban wastewater discharge. What goes through your, what's pumped by the cities and the water districts then goes back through a wastewater treatment plant. The percolation ponds percolate that water back into the groundwater basin. And that water, net return is shown in this column. Rural small community and septic system is there, and small commercial is there. So you can see the right side of the balance of the table takes the water out, and the left side puts it back in.
Mr. Caruso, question. You were speaking about urban wastewater discharge, recharge, inflow, and then outflows, and saying it was about a third. But as I go down the years, for example, 2025, unless my bifocals are messing me up here, 6820 as a percentage of 16750 is substantially different from 4961 in the year 2010 to 14720. So it's not a consistent percent over that 15-year span. Do you know why that is?
Well, they still grow. They should be growing, though. When one side grows, the other one should grow.
Yeah.
It might not be in proportion, and to tell you the truth, I'm not sure.
Okay.
I have an idea why that might be because we're anticipating conservation, exactly. Less landscape.
That's why it would be less landscape.
There you go. That's a great answer.
Yeah, reinforcement.
So the total outflow column is what we've highlighted here on the right-hand side. Because remember, we need to keep those total outflows under 97,700 acre feet a year. However, you'll see that under the scenarios that we have provided in this table, this is the last year that we're going to be under 97,700 acre feet a year. And down in the left-hand corner, you'll see all of the assumptions that went into this table.
The first is that agricultural groundwater pumping increases by about 1.5% a year. So as you go down this table in the ag groundwater, these numbers will grow by 1.5%. That's a very, very modest rate of growth as compared to the past 10 years, and certainly compared to the past 20 or 30 years. So we think this is, a modest rate of increase for ag groundwater.
Well, excuse me, while we're there, that was a question, because you didn't have the percentage increase on the past. It looked to be something like, well, you had three-year increments or something, like looked like about a 20% increase in ag pumping over 3 years. So
right.
Yeah. Something like 8%?
Right. Much higher than this. And the reason why we chose a much lower number is it's difficult to know the future. However, there's two things that are true. Is the amount of new vineyards planted in the county has been leveling off. The 1980, 1997, and the 97 to 2000 were go-go years. But we also noticed that even though they had something like a 50% increase in the acreage of grapes in the groundwater basin over a period of time, over that same period of time, water use only increased 20%. So obviously, they're getting more efficient. And so we assume that efficiencies will continue. That not every vineyard is as efficient as it can be. Some vineyards aren't efficient at all. We assume, though, that in the future, slowly, everyone will get more efficient, simply because that's the way it happens. Especially once your groundwater levels start going down and water being very heavy, it costs more and more to pump it up to the surface. People will find it in their economic self-interest to be more efficient.
Okay, but so if we look at that 1.5% assumption, so I'm in the ballpark of it's been in the past 15-year period, something like 6 or 8.
1.5 is much lower than what it's been for the past 10 or even 20 years, yearly. As I said, we chose a very modest rate of growth because we don't think we're going to repeat the past. We think it's going to be much more efficient.
Okay, but it looks like this is something like a quarter of what it has been. So, I mean, it's not just a little less, it's vastly less.
Substantially less.
Okay, that's what I
wanted.
And
you know something, I'll make the point now. I was going to spring this on you, but I'll make the point now. It doesn't matter.
Nothing matters?
No.
What are we doing here?
What you use for this rate of increase doesn't matter. You could use zero, and it's not going to matter. You're over the safety yield of the basin. Whether you're, going to hell in a handbasket or you're slowly or not, they're talking hydrogeology. The basic hydrogeology is already pretty well known. That's why we're able to do things like these tables, like these water balance tables. The hydrogeology is pretty well known, and we'll see more examples of why it doesn't really matter what water duties you put in here, you're over your safe yield.
Well,
we whisper.
We're talking inflows and outflows, and we do have a quantified outflow. So it just common sense tells me, and I know sometimes we don't deal in common sense, but I know a few of us like to. But if the basin has the ability to subsurface outflow, it may have the ability to subsurface inflow. So that was the only point I was trying to make.
But not from outside the basin. There's not going to be subsurface inflow from outside the basin.
That's the point. Well, the subsurface outflow, I assume, goes outside the basin.
Yeah,
you know,
600 acre feet a year at a constant. That's
right.
And I'll tell you,
maybe gravity,
I'm not sure which boundary that is.
Right. Maybe gravity alone.
I thought the eastern boundary is the fault, and that's usually a no flow boundary.
Mm-hmm.
But there are other parts. You remember, groundwater basins aren't four no-flow boundaries that create a basin. There's movement of water through the edges of a basin, just like there's movement of water through the basin. We also have to remember, and we'll talk about this a little while, that the basin is not one homogeneous type of soil. It's not all gravel or sand. When you look at the geology and the hydrogeology of the basin and how water moves through it, what I was amazed at is how non-regular it is. There's these lenses of clay, there's different formations. Remember, the water exists, first of all, in the Paso Robles Formation. And the Paso Robles Formation, I don't think anyone knows it as a loose, alluvial type of formation that allows a lot of water just to be in it and move through it. That's not the idea most people have.
And in fact, it's not.
It's not, the type of geology we're dealing with.
That's one of the reasons why different parts of the basin are seeming to react differently to overdraft, is that it's not a uniform basin. Now I forgot where I was on my table. we're talking about inflows and outflows. So you can see in the shaded area, we're over 97.7 on this particular scenario. The last two columns are the change in storage, that minus 63,669. That's simply the difference between the inflow and outflow. And then this cumulative change just tracks those change year to year. And you'll see what happens to these numbers. Here we are, all of a sudden we're in the hole, 63,000 acre feet up here in the top right. Well, guess what? We have a good rain year, and all of a sudden we're at 300,000 acre feet to the positive. Several poor rain years, and that number keeps going down. It rains again. The number goes up. So you'll see what happens with when your outflows are over 97,700 acre feet. You have you're in a state of disequilibrium, but your change in storage is going down very, very slowly because you get those gluts of rainfall that put water back in the basin. The higher the higher the outflow number, the more difficult those good rain years are going to have in filling the basin back up. And remember, we're talking two different things. Remember, we have to, over the long term, we're not talking year to year. You know, these numbers don't work year to year, but they do work over a longer period of time. So you can have several years of outflows over inflows. Your basin level is lowering. You have a couple of good rainfall years in that time. The cumulative change in storage goes back up.
Question. As I look over the 15-year projection, I guess it is, even if I'm reading this chart right, even with the increasing total outflows in excess of safe yield starting next year, the cumulative change in storage by 2025 is a positive 268,000 acre feet, presumably. So if that's correct, then how can maybe the definition of safe yield needs a little bit of revision? Because what after all is the goal that we're trying to accomplish? It's not to keep lowering the basin levels so that it's too costly or impractical or impossible to get the water out, right?
Right.
So, what am I missing?
Well, I think we're missing is how to look at the spectrum. It's the United Water Conservation District in Ventura. They built the Lake Piru, the Piru Dam, and they have this project where the water is released down the Santa Clara River to what's called the Freeman Diversion, I believe that's the name. And it takes all this excess flow in the wintertime from the river and puts it into these spreading fields. They then sell that water to all of those ag interests in the Oxnard Plain. If you've ever seen, the Oxnard Plain is where they get probably the most productive farmland in California. It looks a lot like the Oso Flaco Valley. The La Cienega Valley here, they get at least three crops a year. They pump so much water, though, they have seawater intrusion. So the agricultural interests buy the water from United Water Conservation District and use that. That is a big setup. So you have OHI at one end of the spectrum, you have United Water at the other. Now we're swimming somewhere in the middle here, but we're still dealing with large numbers, as you can tell. And so you also have to take into account that this is visionary. This is long-range stuff. That's why one of the things I was going to end with is we have time to work on two things. The first is more information. Everybody needs more data. Everyone needs more information. The model always needs to be updated. But we also have enough information to know we have a bad situation and we need to take some action. That's the conclusion of the presentation. Let's go really quick through some of these assumptions. I want to show you what happens. So down at the bottom, we show that with the vineyard water use in this groundwater pumping scenario is 1.25 to 1.5 acre feet per acre per year. That is what we've been using since 2007. That's a number that was developed by UC Extension. There's thought behind it. It's not a scientifically derived number, but there is some thought behind it, and the difference between 0.25 and 0.5 is where you are. The western part of the basin uses the smaller number. The further out east you go, out towards Shandon, for instance, you start using that higher number for vineyards. And then rural pumping category, we're using 1.7 acre feet per acre per year. So what we've done, also I also wanted to mention that the urban groundwater pumping assumes the inflow of Nacimiento project water, which is the best water because it comes from outside the basin. It's true supplemental water. It's water that's coming from outside the basin, being brought in to supplement the water in the groundwater basin. That's good water. And that's being introduced on a certain schedule by San Miguel, by Templeton, by Atascadero Mutual, and the City of Paso. And their schedules for introducing Nacimiento water into their municipal systems is reflected in these numbers in the municipal pumping category. So you'll also notice the numbers go down, the pumping goes down certain years because they're expecting another, for instance, another phase of the treatment plant to come online, so they'll be lowering their pumping.
So what is the total acre feet of the Nacimiento project?
17.5.
So that will contribute to the overall decrease in basin pumping.
Sure. Yeah, matter of fact, 17,500 acre feet a year, I believe. And I think we have 10,000 of that is allocated. Matter of fact, one of the reasons your commission sent us back in June of 2009 back to do more work was to figure out that exact question, was what's the effect of introducing all of that nasty water on the basin over the next 15 years? And what it shows is it has an effect, but it doesn't keep you...
So just to clarify, these numbers across these projected years, does that cover the entire 17.5 or just 10,000?
Just 10,000.
Just
the 10, other part's unallocated.
It's not allocated yet, yes.
So we're under the urban groundwater pumping column. Is that right?
Right.
Which starts out at 14,720.
Right.
And you're saying without Nacimiento, that would be 24,720?
You know, I'm not sure exactly what it is. It's substantially more than...
Okay, but it's substantially,
yes.
What...
Well, it's about... Seven,
and they're gradually going, right. The water company. Oh, okay.
Right.
All right.
Well, that leads to the next question. When does it interject into what year? It's not an 2010, obviously, under the urban groundwater pumping.
Well, that's a little bit of a complicated issue. The two big users in the basin of nasty water are Atascadero Mutual and City of Paso. City of Paso has its own issues about when it's going to be able to take nasty water. They have to build a treatment plant and treat it. I'm not sure exactly what the schedule was that they gave to Fugro to figure this out. Atascadero Mutual is different. Atascadero Mutual has got 2,000 acre foot allocation. They tap mostly the underflow of the Salinas River. Well, I hope we don't get into this discussion.
Yes,
in good rain years, they pump the heck out of the underflow, and they're not going to need any nasty water. However, in those years, and what that does is it moves the time of disequilibrium out about 8 years, out to 2019. And then in the last scenario, where... keeping vineyard where it was, 1.25 and 1.5, and then changing the rural pumping duty to 1 acre foot from 1.7 acre foot. And what that does is it moves overdraft in a couple of years. So this is why we say, you know, in the long run, it really doesn't matter what these numbers are. The vision here, the long-range implications are not good. And why do we keep on saying that? All of these numbers are estimates. You know that. We could spend days, I have spent days, weeks, arguing over whether these numbers are adequate or not. Or are they accurate? How accurate are they? Let's put some other numbers in there. The one thing I've heard from the professionals for the past 2 years is we need to get past that argument because of this. That is what's showing you that there is a problem. This is the map that shows how water levels have dropped just since 97. This is only 97 to 2009. This is from the groundwater management plan that's in process now for the basin. It shows you this entire area of the basin has been, the water levels have been lowering since 97. This doesn't show you the 1980 to 1997 that showed the beginning of the lowering. We hear anecdotal testimony of drops of 200 feet since the 80s. We know it's happening. We have reports from people who are having to re-drill wells. We know everyone is pulling up water from deeper and deeper levels. So why we know there's a problem and why we know these numbers here have got to be, if not accurate, at least ballpark, is because look what's happened. Look at what's happening. If these were not true, if there was plenty of water here, this would not look like this. And let's go one more. If you remember last year, we mapped what was called the area of concern. This area of concern basically is the area on this slide that shows the darkest reddish colors. That shows where groundwater has dropped that anywhere from 80 to 200 feet since the 80s. We call it the area of concern. And it goes against something that is a basic way we've been looking at this basin. Whenever you look at the basin, we have learned you look at the basin as a whole. Because it's a basin. It's difficult to treat different parts of the basin in different ways because it's interconnected. That being said, we have suggested that you treat the area of concern differently than the rest of the basin. Here's why. And it has to do with real effects on real people and property. If you look at this this map, anybody who's in any of these colors has seen their groundwater levels drop. Some have seen them drop substantially. If we don't do something to stop that drawdown and hopefully bring it back up, in other words, if we don't do something special for this area of concern, those effects on people and real property are going to continue. Because those are where the real effects on people are. So we decided that we need to treat the basin as a whole. However, we need to take this area and we need to clamp down a little bit more on outflows in this area. As I said, simply because there is a real effect on people and property. Could you imagine buying a piece of property and discovering that you have no water or it's going to cost you X thousands, tens of thousands of dollars to redrill a well deeper? You do that and then in three more years or five more years you have to do it again, which is the story of this area. So you'll notice that, let's go to conclusions. That we know that groundwater levels have continued to drop, especially in that portion of the basin from Paso out towards Shandon and both sides of Highway 46. We're also pretty confident that we've reached a safe yield. No matter which way you cut it, that's just the bottom line, is we've reached safe yield and something needs to be done. And we've also decided through those sensitivity analyses in these scenarios that even by changing the water duties for agriculture and for rural pumping, it really doesn't change your results a whole heck of a lot. So arguing or questioning whether the numbers are accurate seems to be last year's argument.
So excuse me for interrupting, but what does that say about the efficacy of conservation then?
To put in there. So for purposes of trying to figure out if we have a problem, no, changing water duties isn't going to get us out of the problem. In other words, it's the changing the paper is not going to solve your problem. It's by through water efficiency and conservation that results in permanent lowering of these of water use in the basin is what's going to solve this problem. And we have examples of that. If only it were so easy. This is the tough part.
dealing, we're behind the eight ball in a lot of this, because we're dealing with laws and policies and constitutions that force us to look at things differently. The first is groundwater law. As you know, groundwater law in California is enshrined in the state constitution. It basically says an overlier has the right to pump water under their property as long as they put it to a beneficial use. And all those uses of water you see in the basin are beneficial uses. So right there, that pretty much tells you regulation is going to be difficult, is going to be a difficult tool to use. Only regulation will be a difficult tool to use to lower water use. There's also limited jurisdictions and authorities for everybody involved. You look at the county. Well, the county has no control over the water. So it's after there a mutual wants to use water and for their customers pump water. The county doesn't have anything to say about that. Same thing with the city of Paso, Templeton CSD. And that's the good news. The bad news is there are thousands of well owners out there in the rural area, all of whom are operating their groundwater wells in reaction to their own decision-making process that's based perhaps on their agricultural use and their agricultural practices. It's perhaps based on what they have on their property, large house with landscaping, or whatever else they have. Thousands of individual decisions are being made every day in this groundwater basin by individual well owners on how to use water. Talk about jurisdictions or authority that are spread out. We also, as we've heard today, we have data limitations. Not only do we have the usual data limitations, but we have this. Yeah, this is a great map. However, you have to remember, it's based on monitoring wells that are pretty far apart. The Flood Control and Water Conservation District does have a program ongoing where they're filling in the gaps so we can have a much better idea of what the drawdown looks like. But we have to remember, we do have pumping and data pumping data gaps in all of this. With the exception of urban water use, we're using water use estimates. They've been firmed up a great deal. However, they're still estimates, and we have to treat them as such. Inflows. Inflows are not well understood. Inflows are also going to be subject to climate change over the long term. The county there's a model that has been done about climate change effects on this county, and basically it's the model result was that rainfall events will occur differently in the future. They'll occur in larger but fewer storms that they think will affect runoff and percolation into groundwater basins. So in the next 30, 40, 50, 75 years, and remember we do look long-term for water, we think climate change will have an effect. And the last bullet item is perhaps the most important thing, and it's the reason we're here, and it's classic, groundwater. There's conflicting needs for groundwater, conflicting uses for groundwater. There's grape growers, and there's people living in houses. There's golf courses, and there's small commercial businesses. There's cities, and there's agriculture. The conflicts over water, there should be a Western, a movie made about this. I think there was. The conflicting needs of groundwater is what's driving this issue. Remember, your commission, you deal with the general plan policies every day, probably, every Thursday, that deals with this. Ag Policy 11 gives precedence for groundwater to agriculture. The new conservation and open space element is full of policies on collaborative groundwater management. So the conflicting needs of groundwater is what's driving this whole thing. There's a little tutorial on levels of severity, 1, 2, and 3. 1 is what we're at now, and it has to do with the number of years that we think we're going to reach dependable supply. 9 years at level 1, 7 years at level 2, and at dependable supply, level 3. We're going to be recommending that groundwater basin, the sub-basin, and the area of concern go to level severity 3.
I mean, I understand why it would be good politically and just actually for an educational point, but if you were in a different part of the Paso Robles groundwater basin, you'd still be in an LOS 3. So, I mean, yeah, but
But perhaps your action recommendations outside of the area of concern, well, let's put it the other way. The recommendations for what to do in the area of concern should be looked at more rigorously than outside.
Well, we're really, really worried and scared as hell, but now here we're really worried.
Exactly.
Okay. Yeah, no good reason, in other words. Okay, I get it. No, I get it.
So we're going to talk a little bit about the recommended actions in the RCS. And there's things like the groundwater management plan that is in process right now, being run by the city of Paso and the flood control district, I guess, or public works. I'm not sure which of their hats they're wearing. We are recommending ongoing agricultural data collection, such as the UC study, UC extension. Brand new recommendation. So the year and several months that you sent us back to redo this did result in a new recommendation, and that's the Rural Pumping Conservation Program. We realized that every one of these sectors had somebody paying attention to them with a conservation program. If you're in the urban sector, you are bombarded by conservation messages. City of Paso, Atascadero, Templeton, they're all focused on conservation. If you're in the ag sector, you've been bombarded by organizations that are leading the charge for ag water conservation. You're probably on a committee, or you've heard about the water committees up there. The only sectors, and it's a substantial sector, that has none of this are the individual pumpers out there, and there are thousands of them. So we're recommending a conservation program very similar to what a city perhaps would run for those rural well owners. Who's going to do it, how much it's going to cost, and all that we're still figuring out. But we think this is probably the best new idea anyone's had in the past year at least. Public Works is enhancing all of their data collection efforts. Always looking to improve that, and we have that recommendation. And of course, any new development in the groundwater basin is going to have to offset their new water use. Period. There's no way around this. This is absolutely necessary. A lot of this is going to entail outreach, not only to the cities but now to the rural folks. We're going to have to develop a program to continue all of the basin studies. You know, the big model efforts back in 2005 now have to happen again. At the next hearing, you'll see there's a RAC recommendation for establishing what's called a zone of benefit. We've thought about that. We're not exactly sure how it would happen, but we've decided that we probably would seek to add that to our recommendations. The zone of benefit would merely create a group of property owners who would choose to tax themselves or whatever to pay for all of the work that's necessary that we need to do in the basin, the new models, for instance, the outreach program, the incentives or subsidies. Remember how cities subsidize plumbing retrofits all the time. They use their money they get from their water rates. A portion of water rates goes into those subsidy programs. Well, individual well owners, we have no water rates for them. So somehow we're going to have to come up with the funds to subsidize these incentives for people to save water. We've asked the Paso Robles Wine Country Alliance to establish best management practices for wineries. A great piece of work they've done, attached, I believe, to the last page of the RCS. We're going to be implementing those on a case-by-case basis. We probably should establish best management practices perhaps for other uses that are prevalent in the groundwater basin. And then on the last thing, and you'll notice how we've done this, we've divided the recommendations into monitoring and conservation on one side and growth and development on the other side. Just remember, the county does not regulate water per se. We don't say you can withdraw 10 acre feet of water from the groundwater basin. We do, however, regulate land use. We have to always remember we can't use the authority we don't have to solve this problem. So we can't go down the road, we can't waste our time thinking about how can we limit these people's access to groundwater. Maybe eventually, but that's not
That's not productive thinking right now. Instead, we have to focus on the authority that we have and try to figure out the best way of using that building and land use authority. And the way that we are suggesting, and the POMO, unlike Los Osos, that has an older housing stock, and so not too many houses had low flow. Out in the rural area of North County, there was a big building boom in the past 10 years out there, so we would hazard a guess that perhaps retrofit upon sale is not going to give us the savings that we would want out of a program that takes quite a bit of administration and cost. However, that still remains to be seen. Changes to Title 19 for new construction, using different standards for construction, for water use, different types of fixtures, different landscaping restrictions. The other thing is you'll notice that a lot of these measures are skip the ag sector. There's a bit of a discussion about the wineries. A winery is going to fall into one of these categories that are going to require water conservation and discretionary permits. And the answer is yes. So the question is being answered: should we broaden our horizon to address all development, not just discretionary development? In other words, your commission decides on discretionary development. You have the ability to put special conditions on a use of the groundwater basin to reduce their water use. This thought is, well, maybe even we need to change our building ordinance. So even projects that don't require a land use permit, just a building permit, also have to do fairly substantial things to save water. Finally, the Water Resource Advisory Committee has met, subcommittee met, the whole committee met, and they have some substantial number of comments. A lot of them we've already included in the RCS. We had a window of a few days, and these are things that we think improved the resource capacity study, and so we stole them and put them in and didn't give credit to the RAC. We'll have we'll address other comments, RAC comments, before the hearing. Let's talk a bit about the groundwater management plan that's ongoing. There's a little bit of an issue here, and I'll explain it and then let you know that we're going to address it before the next hearing. Something that you should be thinking about, though. There's a groundwater management plan that's being done jointly by the city of Paso Robles and the county. It is a voluntary, collaborative process of all the property owners and other stakeholders in the basin. You'll notice that one of the recommended actions is that groundwater management plan be used, and the object of the groundwater management plan be to lower levels of severity. So in other words, put actions in that groundwater management plan that will lead to levels of severity in the basin being lowered from the recommended 3 to 2 to 1. The issue with that is that the groundwater management plan is seen as a voluntary, collaborative process amongst the stakeholders, and some of the stakeholders question whether our putting it in as a mandatory action in the RCS takes the groundwater management plan out of that voluntary category that the city and the flood control district have put it in. It's an important enough question that we are still taking a look at this. As we understand, on one hand, they're right. However, on the other hand, we're dealing with a resource capacity study, the purpose of which is to reduce levels of severity. And the actions that it's recommending should go towards reducing those levels of severity. So you can see there's a little bit of a conflict between the purpose of the groundwater management plan and where the resource capacity study would like to go. Before the 23rd, we'll come up with a meaning of the minds, and we'll be going one way or the other on this.
But so, excuse me, so on that, the question isn't whether the actions would be taken there, it's just whether they would be included as part of that plan?
Correct.
Okay. So that's an administrative. Oh, got it. Okay.
All right, so the last, you let me talk a long time. Our schedule is on the screen. Today is the study session. In 2 weeks, on the 23rd, we'll be coming back to your commission for the actual public hearing, and you can expect a much fuller room for that. And then we have the board hearing already noticed for October 19th. One of the reasons we did that is board time is getting more and more difficult to get this year. Oh, and that's it. I guess that's the end of staff remarks. Mr. Stevenson, you wanted to make some opening remarks for which you weren't here. So I was wondering if you wanted to do that.
Thank you, Mr. Russo. Well, I was in a conversation with the county administrative officer, so a little bit of a priority there. Only just to say that
is in my area, I did want to have a little bit of discussion about that. I'm looking at the black and white version and my staff report of that colored area of concern, difference in groundwater elevation map, and I didn't see the real dark areas over by the Atascadero subbasin. So I wondered if you could ask what went into your recommendation for LOS 3 for that subbasin.
Sure. I'm going to try to find the... let me find... So we have a water balance table just for the Atascadero subbasin. And let's see, which one is... Oops, let me see if I can remember where the thing is here. The safe yield is 16,400 acre-feet a year, as you can see, it's right down here on the table. Atascadero subbasin is the opposite of the main basin. There's very little agricultural use in the Atascadero subbasin. The primary users, I believe, it's over 60% of the users are the Atascadero Mutual Water Company and half of the municipal supply of the city of Paso Robles. It's known as a Thunderbird well field. Pumps water out of the subbasin. So the growth in the subbasin water use is going to be somewhat limited when we bring the nasty water in. So you'll see what happens in this column, the total outflows. Remember, we're at 16.7 is safe yield. Because of introducing water, and you'll see how the numbers don't go up too much and they go down on urban groundwater pumping as more nasty water enters the Atascadero subbasin. This number fluctuates, the total outflows, doesn't get over safe yield until 2016, then bounces around a little bit, and then finally looks like it goes in. So it's a different situation, different users, however, the same result is that within X number of years, we're going to see a safe yield reached.
Okay. I am aware that there is a proposed major development called Eagle Ranch, I think it is. It's something like 3,500 acres of development, 3,500 acres roughly in conservation easement. But I don't know. I assume there will be hundreds of homes and a hotel and quite some other recreation components to that development, so it sounds like there'll be a lot of water use there, and I wonder if those projected projections for that development were made, and if they have been included in your table here.
I believe they have. That's been adopted to the City of Atascadero General Plan already. It's anticipated.
What was it? The annexation was contemplated or adopted back in...
Yeah. Right, the annexation hasn't been completed,
no.
But the general plan designation for that project has been part of their general plan for some time.
Right. So you're saying that means the water was included in this?
I believe so.
It was using their
general plan projections.
So these are Atascadero Mutual Water Company numbers?
The urban water pumping came from the urban water pumpers, within their schedule of what they think they're going to be using in the next 15 years, based on conservation, based on SB 7,
the mandatory 20% reduction per capita water use by 2020,
right,
and by their schedule of how they're going to accept supplemental nasty water coming into the basin. So there's a number of things going into this outflow column.
Okay, so all right. You mentioned one of the constraints had to do with that the county is laboring under is that you don't necessarily control pumping by water purveyors.
Correct.
Okay, and I believe Atascadero Mutual would fall into that category. So the county is not in a decision-making process about the annexation then?
Correct.
Okay.
Right? The county has no role in that Eagle Ranch annexation. That's LAFCO and the city?
Well, the county is a party to the process, but primarily in terms of what's referred to as a memorandum of agreement or understanding on how that process would occur. The county
make decisions on projects that are in particular locations with respect to these basins and sub-basins. How do we decide these impacts? It just, even though there's a lot of this wonderful data here, it's not immediately obvious, at least to me. What, for example, if this development does proceed in the Atascadero and it's a large one, what's the effect on the rest of the basin?
Well, that you're right, Commissioner O'Grady. That's one of the problems we're dealing with. It's the authorities and jurisdictions are spread out. So this resource capacity study isn't going to play too much of a role, I assume, in City of Atascadero or Atascadero Mutual's decision-making process. It doesn't have to. It will play a role, of course, in the county decision-making process because that's who's doing it. The conservation and open space element has a water chapter to it. Goal 2 is about groundwater. And it's not that long, a goal with policies. But it does emphasize one thing. It emphasizes collaboration. And I know this is probably a disappointment. We've come to the conclusion that's the answer to the question of what do you do about these authorities and these jurisdictions that are so broad and don't speak to the right things. Well, you collaborate, and you get all of these people, you get Atascadero Mutual, the cities, the county, the district, to together make these decisions on how best to proceed with this limited and conflicted supply. There's no magic bullet, and I don't have an answer for you as to how do we do this. We're going to have to move step by step, slowly. You know, and I promised I wasn't going to say this, but I have to. I have to say it. Do you know what the result, if we're unsuccessful, if we just gave up, if your commission said, you know, this is just too difficult, there's nothing we can do, let's throw our hands up, which is where we were at just about 6 months ago, we came around and decided, no, we need to do this. We need to be patient, we need to be collaborative, we need to identify all those tools that we can possibly use. And it's because Mr. Wynn from the Water Resource Advisory Council yelled at us the last time we mentioned the alternative, which is adjudication. I don't even want to say it out loud. The what's going to happen is if we don't try to collaboratively, if everybody doesn't in the basin doesn't work together on this, is the ultimate result, of course, is going to be adjudication. And we have examples of adjudication in this county, and they're not pretty things. They're extremely expensive, and they don't get you anywhere. So I think we have to look at what the alternative is, and that will be the impetus to push us forward in this very plodding, very slow way, step by step, getting our hands around this.
Well, I was fortunate enough to have been appointed to the Water Resources Advisory Committee, and in my 5 years there, I feel like
was very beneficial and helps me all the time at these meetings, and it certainly apprised me of how complex the issue is. And I have seen in those 5 years what wonderful progress has been made. I think this is a wonderful step forward, and I think is going to help explain our situation to the public much better than could have been done years ago. However, we still have cases that arrive on our plate with 12 houses with a little bit of water that, you know, there's some indication that we ought to turn it down because it's not enough, it doesn't totally offset the water use, and yet in another part of the same basin, there's 100 homes going in. And that's what's hard for some folks, including me, to understand. But hopefully this will help go a long way in that regard.
Thank you, Commissioner O'Grady. Other questions at this point?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yes, I asked most of mine as we went through the study session, but I come down to one more on where we had the different areas of severity. We had the overall basin, we had the Atascadero sub-basin, and then we had the area of concern. Is there a possibility to have different severity levels dedicated to each one of those areas? And what I'm thinking about specifically is if we get more data on the vineyard growth, would that be able to put us into a level of severity 2 on the overall basin? You gave the
long slide into oblivion. There's nothing that's going to stop it. Water use doesn't suddenly stop in groundwater basins, especially in this one that's so big with so many aspects of the use not regulated or not subject to some type of overall water conservation program. So the purpose of the RCS and the purpose of RMS, the aim, is to reduce levels of severity. So we hope we get there. So what we would expect that in every, you know, we're going to be here every 2 years probably.
Well, my immediate...
We'll have opportunities to say, okay, it looks like we've stretched out that resource. That's one of the objects of the recommendations, is to use the resource at such a different rate that stretches out the time when it's the lack of, where it gets to where it's not sustainable. We just don't have to do this incrementally several times in the future to see where we are.
Well, what I'm specifically thinking of, again, is if we get different data that would justify the level severity 2 rather than the level severity 3. If a Wine Country Alliance, for example, were to come in with some data that would kick it back into that level of severity 2. And then, furthermore, there's 7,500 acre-feet, I believe, of Nacimiento water unallocated. So if jurisdictions decided to take that, and that could immediately change the situation also.
Sure. There's two things I'd like to respond to. The first is we're going to discover that extra 7,000 plus acre-feet of NASI is going to be one of the answers to the questions here. Now, how do you force someone to take
that? Who's going to step up for that?
I'm not exactly sure, but someone will have to step up and take that to offset groundwater pumping, number one. Number two, it is certainly possible that as we proceed year through year with additional study, these numbers, these water duties, these estimates will change. But I'm not counting on that. And the reason that we don't count on that is I guess it's been driven into our heads pretty strongly that that pumping depression, the area of concern, is indicative of overpumping, and that you can't have a water duty for vineyards that isn't consistent with what you see, what your eyes see with lowering water levels. And that's the reason why the City of Paso, one of the reasons why the City of Paso did that, got the peer review done. And if you read the peer review, parts of it are fascinating, and parts of it are just hydrogeologists, you know, going at it, you know, one against the other. But what we take away from that peer review is we keep on going back to the Kona depression, to the pumping depression. And if all of the water tables aren't accurate, if we really did have excess water year after year and lots of it, that pumping depression would look a heck of a lot different than it does now. So
maybe the vineyard data is irrelevant because of the facts on the ground, or the facts under the ground.
So here's a different way of looking at that. What happens if the three-year water study by UC Extension does determine that vineyards are using 50% less water? Well, then what in the world is explaining that gigantic cone of depression?
Well, I'm thinking of that. What explains that? And you know, the city of Paso pumps out in that area.
Well, we know exactly how much they pump.
And it's not enough to create that. Okay.
Tiny amount. It's about 3,000 acres.
Do you believe would groundwater store? You know, I'm thinking of solutions here. And have you looked into groundwater storage as a potential solution? Because is a cone of depression?
Excuse me, Commissioner White. I'm just not sure how much latitude this being a study session. Do we have latitude to bring up new ideas here or questions? Or maybe Mr. McNulty?
I think it's fine. This is going to be a quasi-legislative action if and when you ever take it anyway. So I think you're okay.
Oh, he's optimistic. Okay, go ahead then. Carry on.
Okay, thank you. I was just, the way I understand it, and that's the other thing to clarify if I'm understanding this correctly, this cone of depression is just created from rapid pumpings, not allowing the basin to reach its equilibrium because of water migration. Is that how you understand it?
I'm not sure I understand it, to tell you the truth. I think that's one of the reasons why we're going to be doing additional work on the basin.
I guess simplistically, if you have a big gulp soda and you're taking a drink, the equilibrium of the soda stays consistent. If you're drinking a thick milkshake or a Slurpee, you can create a cone of depression because it doesn't keep its equilibrium. And I guess that's the way, the simplistic view of how I see this, that the rapid pumping won't allow the basin to keep its equilibrium because the water has to migrate through soils.
Right,
and I don't know if that's an accurate.
Pumping has to be based on something.
Yes.
And in this case, it's based on the acreage of the particular ag use and the urban pumping and all of the other smaller pumpers.
And that goes to my follow-up question about what a solution may be. If there could be that rapid pumping done maybe in certain times of the year and do surface storage to allow that migration and equilibrium to find itself during the summer months, or the drought months. Mm. I don't know if that's something anyone's looked into.
We haven't thought about that. I don't like to bring up problems in response to a potential solution. However, we do always have to remember, think about, well, how do we implement that? Because remember, your commission, the board, we don't have a real strong regulatory role here. Unless there is a discretionary land use permit in front of us, we can't say you are going to do this. It would have to be done collaboratively with the stakeholders in the basin. We would have to think about that and see how best that could be done.
Well, that's short term.
And it will be implemented with everything else in the conservation element.
But as far as future reservoirs, which would...
You're talking off-stream reservoirs.
Well, any reservoir to capture this runoff, is that something that will be reconsidered with all circumstances that we're touched with here, that we're hit with?
You know, when you mention that, I think of a dam on the Salinas River to divert those high flows into the...
Yeah.
But I don't think that's a good thing to say.
I was thinking more of something similar to Nacimiento, you know, which would be, you know, catching other large tributaries.
I don't know. I don't know about if the time of big water projects is over or not. I keep hearing people say that the days of the big water projects are over because of environmental and economic issues. But who knows? As water becomes more and more dear, those solutions might get back on the table.
I'm not knowledgeable enough to rule that out, but I know of a wide range of impacts that we're understanding better and better, and a lot of dams getting torn down for various reasons and why it's problematic. So it doesn't seem really likely in the near term that's going to be a local solution.
Okay. Thank you.
One question. This study on the vineyards by the Extension Group, what's their timetable? When will they have better information?
It's a three-year study. They're at the end of the first year. So we're expecting results from them about the end of 2012. And We hope it just doesn't bring up more questions.
Will they have some interim information, hopefully, before that?
I asked Mr. Mark Batney, who's doing it. I don't know if you know Mr. Batney from UC Extension. In answer to that exact question, he said no, because he wants to go through the entire 3 years before anybody uses the information to draw any conclusions. And the reason they're doing 3 years is they want to capture different rainfall years and different conditions. And so he was very careful, and he knows this is a hot potato, so he wasn't going to make any proclamations.
Well, what if it's three dry years? I mean,
well, we already know it's not. They included last year, which was a pretty wet year.
Yeah,
I'm hoping that one year is a dry year. Yeah. That would be perfect if one of them is.
Well, not in everybody's mind. Okay, thank you.
Other questions? Okay, Commissioner Christensen.
Yeah, I had just one question, but before that, I did want to kind of throw my two cents into the discussion we're having. Certainly, any further solutions are going to be, I'm sure, at least considered by the county. But I do want to direct people to the Yates peer review, which I thought was very helpful. And the kind of the thing I got from that the most was exactly what you had talked about at the beginning, Mr. Caruso, which was that it doesn't matter if you start arguing data bits. You know, half the water, twice the water, three times the water, no water. We're in trouble. So that he keeps talking about the fact that even though that you can change these measurements all around, and it seems like it would work out, but that the fact is that these hugely declining wells indicate that there's a problem that we don't really quite understand yet. So just changing information from the vineyards or getting slightly better data or adjusting it a little bit here and there, that's really not the answer to what we're trying to deal with this resource capacity study. So I hope I'm just personally putting in a thing, we hope we don't end up having long discussions about little data bits next time, although of course we'll have to see what we come up with. So that's one thing. And then the other thing is to me, the other important thing that was said in all of the reports and in the peer review study, as well as the Fugrow and the Todd and all those other things, was that these areas are connected, that you can talk about sub-areas, and then there was even some discussion about whether there is an actual sub-basin, but that they are connected. So if you were to, you know, if vineyards were to use only an eighth of the amount of water they're using, that would be really great, but it wouldn't necessarily, I mean, it takes everybody doing it all together. It isn't just, you know, well, the vineyard area can go to a level two, but the Estrella area has to stay at level three, because all the water is running together and all connected. So, In my mind, somehow, actually, you know, I mean, I'm kind of going the opposite. Name all the areas of areas of concern. They're all three. That's what you're saying overall when you label the entire basin a three. But anyway, that's just kind of my humorous comment for the moment. I'm an average person, I'm not a water person. We'll look at that and go, okay, so I just want you to be very explicit about it.
Yeah.
Because it's still hardly any water. Is that what you're trying to say?
Exactly.
Okay.
And remember, we're going over, these numbers are this way when we're just over safe yield. Well, what's going to happen when we are substantially over safe yield?
Okay.
These numbers disappear very quickly.
Okay.
And, you know, these are the numbers where your commission has probably heard this from geologists or engineers in the past, that they'll point to these numbers like this. Oh, go over water, plenty of water. Where they're being disingenuous.
Disingenuous at best.
And they're not telling you the truth at first.
Okay. Okay, I don't have it though, following up. You have it now, but I'm sorry to be the slow one in the box.
Yeah.
I want to get it. I'm still not getting it.
So in other words, so keep going, because keep going.
Maybe I can help.
Help me with that last right.
If you translate. The volumes of water that appear in that last column over the entire area of the basin.
Okay.
What do you think it is? 6 inches deep? A foot? See, so
Okay.
And that's why I would make a suggestion to add to your table down there a footnote as to what, and maybe try to translate, just to say this corresponds to a depth of such and such applied over the entire basin. And I think that would help people understand or mitigate against the erroneous interpretations of that last column. Okay.
Okay, thank you.
Sure. And then I wanted to follow up on Commissioner White's concern and a little bit on my own before about Atascadero sub-basin. I attended, I think it was 3 board meetings of the Atascadero Mutual Water Company when they were deliberating about how much Nassamiana water to purchase. Okay. And what the rationale was for buying that water. Was it for growth or not? The answer was no, it was not. The concern was that in periods of drought and or God forbid there's something that causes portions of the basin to become contaminated to where the water cannot be treated satisfactorily in order to provide it to consumers. This was sort of a plan B for Atascadero Mutual Water. And so it is concerning to me when I asked you the question, is Nassamiana water figured into these numbers? And the answer was yes. That wasn't consistent, number in the Atascadero sub-basin. And number two, it leaves our area without a plan B. If that water's factored into the whole basin and all the users within the basin and something happens, where do we go from there? So I just, there isn't another Nassamiana, is there?
So without out there, we still haven't opened this to public comment. We have a few speakers with, so let's do that and then we'll come back and carry on or not carry on. So I've got a few speaker slips, looks like about everybody here represented. I see Mr. Eisensee here who hasn't spoken. Did you have anything to add to this, Mr. Eisensee, or just here in case called? Okay. Thanks. So I'll call the speakers, Sue Left first and then Della Barrett.
Hopefully I can have just a few more seconds beyond the 3 minutes. I can speak on behalf of the REC.
Yes, sure. 5 minutes is fine then.
Okay. My name is Sue Luft. I'm a resident of the rural El Pomar area, east of Templeton, and have a small vineyard. And I'm a member of the Water Resources Advisory Committee. I'm also a Crescent sub-area representative on the Paso Robles Groundwater Basin Advisory Committee, Groundwater Basin Management Plan Advisory Committee. And was the chair of the RAC subcommittee that reviewed and commented on the Paso Robles Groundwater Basin Resource Capacity Study. I'd like to provide a summary of our RAC subcommittee report and the action taken by the RAC.
Ms. Left, we're just getting enough feedback that I'm distracted. Somebody in the box, can we try to cut that feedback? Okay, excuse me, go ahead.
Okay. Consensus was reached by our subcommittee. That's better?
I think that's okay.
Okay. Regarding the Paso Resource Capacity Study, we prepared a report that is included in the staff report for your September 23rd meeting. On September 1st, the RAC voted 18-2 with 2 abstentions to approve the subcommittee report, which is one minor change. The change is that staff be requested to investigate the cost of providing fire. There are disagreements amongst experts regarding the specifics. There is general agreement that the basin is nearing its safe yield, even with the introduction of the Nacimiento Project water. Some very important recommendations are included in this RCS and are supported by the RAC. One recommendation is that the county evaluate a funding mechanism for studies of the basin that spreads the cost amongst the users of the basin. This could involve establishment of a zone of benefit district, for example. I'd also like to comment quickly as an individual. The water well on our property draws from the Paso Robles groundwater basin. We have monitored the well level on a monthly basis for the past 3 years using an airline, and we have data on the water well levels on an intermittent basis since the well was drilled 12 years ago. generally when the well's been pulled to be worked on or when the pump's gone dry. Our water level dropped another 4 feet last month. The drop has averaged 1.18 feet per month over the last 17 months. Over the last 12 years, we've seen an average of 7 feet per year drop in our well level. This is a total drop of 85 feet. The well is drilled to a total depth of 355 feet, so it's not a shallow well, and it is a new well. We and probably most of our neighbors, if this slope continues, will run out of water in either 9 to 19 years. This is an unsustainable situation, which is a cause for great concern. In the rural areas, we don't have any potential new supplies of water, and the value of our property and other properties in the basin is tied to the availability of water. So, thank you.
Barrett, followed by Mr. Wynn.
I'm Della Barrett. I live in South Atascadero, and I'm a member of the Paso Robles Groundwater Management Advisory Committee, and I'm the fifth district appointee to the RAC. I followed Dan Grady in his big footsteps there. And I was a member of the RAC RCS subcommittee, and I have very few things to add. But just to remind you that generally, when you pull from deeper in your well, the lower down in the basin that you're pulling from, that not only has the water quantity declined, but the water quality declines as you start pulling from deeper in the basin. And that's because there are more salts and more minerals in the water. And so it's not like it's all one big clear bathtub and the bottom of the tub is just as good as the top of the tub. And for growth, it is so easy to approve projects just one at a time. And I remember a project that was here before the commission not long ago, and I remember one of the commissioners who said, in terms of the Paso Robles groundwater basin, this is a 0000% this 14-home or something subdivision. And so when you're looking at this study, just remember how easy it is to have growth that will keep subtracting from what we have now. And and while you were talking about the area of concern affects real people, all of this area affects real people. If we don't have water, we don't have any property value. Or if our water is really so limited, we don't have any property value. So I know from your comments, you're really addressing these issues very carefully, and I commend you for that. Thank you.
Just quickly, first, this effort has been a three-year effort, and it's been an amazing example of collaboration. It's very few times that we get incorporated cities, counties, community services district, farmers, stakeholders, mutual water companies, all sitting at the table and agreeing about anything. And yet, I think we've found tremendous broad-based support for this report. It's not that we can't improve on it, but it's been a really good effort. James Caruso especially deserves credit for all of his work to give us leadership in that. Secondly, even though this is a solid initial draft, there are clearly voids in the report that we just don't know, and there are some conflicts that are still unresolved. I think that goes with water. I think that's just part of the thing. I hope you won't be put off by saying, you know, this needs a lot more study before we come to conclusions. I think we need to come to conclusions this year, do it fairly quickly, and then say, now what can we do to make this even better? I think that's the only rational way to do it. But the basin may not be in overdraft as the law defines overdraft. The law would tend to look at the entire basin as some sort of thing, but for us. So don't see them as the enemy. See them as people that can show us on the way out. Secondly, I really wish that somehow we could have either a forum or a joint meeting of your commission and the Board of Supervisors. We need to get three or four water attorneys to sit down and answer questions briefly, as attorneys generally are reluctant to do. Mr. McNulty, of course, being a shining exception to that. Water law is not like common sense law. Water law is not like any other kind of law that I know of. It came right out of the gold rush. It's odd stuff. It is so archaic and so counterintuitive that in 1998, when the city of Barstow and Mojave Water District went to the California Supreme Court, we all assumed they were going to say, no, that stuff is passé. This is what really makes sense. They didn't. Read the Mojave decision. It says that old archaic stuff is still the law of the land, that is constitutional law. What it means is, if you put a Category 3 or Category 4 or anything else on farmers, it doesn't take anything away from them. They can continue to pump as much as they need to beneficially to do what they need to do. Farmers and mutual water companies are in a special category all alone. Cities are second class. CSDs, which I'm on the board of, we're second class. Everybody else is second class to those overlying users. That's just the way it works. If things got, in some sort of science fiction future, desperate enough and the law didn't change, they could red tag an entire city and let farmers continue to farm. It's just the way the law works. I don't expect you to take my word for it. I am not an attorney, but you should figure out some way of getting some water attorneys to sit down with you and explain what can and cannot actually be done under the law. Some of the things that we think are solutions simply aren't on the table. And last, I would urge you to get a clear understanding of what kind of message are we going to send on conservation. I believe that many times we send the wrong message. Conservation, as I understand it, should be we are going to use less water so that we will have water in reserve so that when we get to the dry years, what Mr. O'Grady was saying, we'll have water then. Often, though, the message is different. It's let's use less water so that we can build more. And believe me, that is a non-winning message for anybody out there in the public. In fact, in my community, we have people who deliberately use more water. They're doing their part to slow down growth in the Pomo. So we need to get clear on that. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Wynn. Ms. Bedrogi is the last speaker.
Hi, good afternoon, commissioners. My name is Lisa Bedrogi. I'm the Government Affairs Director for the Paso Robles Wine Country Alliance. And I just want to let you know that we are very engaged in this issue. I heard reference to our organization several times today already. We're very much concerned with the issue and stepping forward to be a team player in coming up with solutions. In fact, last week we had a tour and wish some of your commission could have made it out to the tour, but specifically showed what we're doing in the vineyard setting and winery setting as well in the way of water conservation. And I think that's the real challenge for us. We don't look at water use in terms of acre feet per year in a vineyard setting. We look at it in terms of gallons of water per vine per week. We use so much technology and innovation to really get down to the science of how much water does that individual vine need. And that was well represented during this tour. So I want to let you know that we are, again, very concerned with the issue and really working hard to do our part, although we've been doing our part for the last 15, 20 years as the industry has developed. Those vineyards have been developed and managed with sustainable and conservation practices. So in terms of what can we do further, that's a question yet to be truly answered. I wanted to clarify as well the UC Extension study. That is a study that basically Mark Batney, and as referenced in all of the reports that have been done, was approached several years back and asked how much water does a vineyard use, and he estimated with some, you know, scientific guesstimation that it was the 1.25 acre feet per acre. And we have believed all along that probably is an overestimate. And in fact, he said it was a 1.25 plus or minus 0.5. And in fact, in the Yates report, the peer review, it says that develops an uncertainty of 30,000 acre feet per year. So that is a significant uncertainty that I think we are doing our part to resolve. UC Extension came to us last fall and said, we want to do the study, we plan to do the study, but we have a couple problems. First of all, we don't have funding available for us right now, and we need your help in getting the participation. Again, how we go about doing finding the solutions, and as Commissioner Christian said, is we know there's a problem, but we really don't understand why yet. So I think as we move forward, we need to be thoughtful in identifying whatever solutions there truly are in making sure that numbers do count and that whatever we're doing, we're not doing in vain and not really addressing the problems that we have. So just we'll be providing more comments at your next public hearing, but want to let you know we are engaged. Thanks.
Thank you. Anyone else here that we're not seeing that wants to come forward? Okay, so we'll bring it back to staff and the commission. That's other comments from staff after public comments?
One thing I wanted to correct, Commissioner O'Grady was asking about that area, it was like a void area. Well, just check, and it looks like it is a geologically is not water bearing. So it's like an island of no groundwater in the basin.
Good call.
That's all I know from the book.
I'd rather be lucky.
Okay, well, I had two more questions, then I'll get to. So Ms. Luft also brought this out about the flow meters, the proposal for flow meters on new wells. And so my question at this point is, it seems like we've required flow meters on a couple of projects sort of here and there to try to determine what they're using. Seems like one or two. But I believe there was a car wash project in Napomo that we wanted that was out in some kind of non-commercial area or somewhere we wanted a flow meter. Do you have some memory of that? So I guess it doesn't matter so much exactly which projects, but you kind of generally whether we've put them on that requirement on projects already and whether we would clearly have the authority to do that. Or that's in question.
Clearly there is the authority in this, okay. When you're dealing with discretionary land use permits to do that. And there are three reasons to do it or not to do it. And there's different things that the purpose is different. The first is the longer term broad requirement, the broad need. It's if we have a flow meter on a well and they're recording, monitoring, and actually reporting, we're going to start to have a record of water use for different uses. So, for instance, in rural pumping, well, if all 1,000 or 5,000 lots had a meter on it, we would know exactly what the water duty is overall. But we don't, so we don't know. We have to estimate it. So that's one reason to require.
Right. Well, I see clear reasons why we would want to. I guess I just wondered if there was already some precedent, if we'd already been doing it or not.
Right, and I'm not sure why you did it in those particular instances. The reason in the POMO might have been to make sure they're using the amount of water that they said they were going to
use. I believe that's the case.
Which is sort of a back check on what you've already approved. We're going to be recommending flow meters for a different reason than that.
Commissioner, why wouldn't we ask staff to include as a condition for every project that we review for discretionary permit that has a well? Have that flow meter requirement going forward and at least get it on the table because you know how many conditions there are, we may forget. So couldn't that be a standard staff condition whenever there's a well?
Thank you. That's partially where I was going, to what degree we've done that or not.
I was going to speak to that exact idea because that's something that we had thought about a while ago. And in talking to other people, for instance, the Flood Control and Water Conservation District, there are a number of reasons to not do that. The biggest reason is we have to be a bit more strategic in what are we monitoring? What are we metering and monitoring? Why do we want that information? Is that information that we're going to be useful to us or not? So what we're going to probably end up recommending is on a case-by-case basis, answering these particular questions on each case-by-case basis, you get to the result of, do we need a flow meter on this? Do they need to be part of an ongoing monitoring program? But apparently there's you know, lots of meters you could put on, but what's going to be done with that information? Is it valuable information? Well, as it turns out, that's pretty questionable on a lot of projects. So we need to be a little bit more strategically than putting that requirement on everything. But what I think when you're dealing, when your commission is dealing in the Paso Groundwater Basin, that question at least has to be asked. Is this an instance when we would need a flow meter, and do we need to set up that reporting protocol on this particular problem?
So are you coming up with that criteria already as part of the proposal, then for when we would and when we wouldn't? Or?
We were actually coming up with the criteria of when we would need a groundwater monitoring. We want your well for the biannual.
Yeah, Glenn Marshall, County Public Works. How to wait, which addresses the coastal zone water wells, gives us that discretion. I don't think we have anything in the inland, so it might have to be ordinance-driven.
You mean, so that was, again, part of my question. So right now, we don't necessarily have the discretion on inland projects to even ask for the flow meters without something,
There's no ordinance that tells us we can really do it. But yeah, I mean, discretionary,
we
could.
We can.
We can ask.
But we are also working on... That was one of the recommendations from the annual summer report from the RAC last year that the board has directed us to implement, which is, Glenn was saying that in Title 8, there's a requirement that whenever we get a request for a well permit, not associated with a discretionary land use permit, but any well permit that Environmental Health gets, if you're in the coastal zone, they have, by ordinance, the right to ask for metering, monitoring, reporting on that use of that well. And it has criteria in the ordinance as to when or why we would want that information. Environmental Health is going to take the lead in the next probably 8 months to move that Title 8 from just coastal to the entire county. So for non-discretionary permits, when anybody comes in with a well permit to Environmental Health, that's one of the things that they'll check off is, do we need metering and monitoring on this well?
Okay.
At that point, Public Works, through the Flood Control and Water Conservation District, will work with Environmental Health to determine whether that next step is necessary.
Okay, thank you. I understand that better. And the second point Mr. Wynn brought up about attorneys, sort of water attorney involvement, I'm not clear how clear the line is with staff, or you, Mr. Caruso, on what's allowable. Once we get into talking about what we're going to do, the fun stuff on the 23rd, what actual ordinances may look like and new rules, would it be useful to have the water attorney there, or is there a pretty clear line that you're comfortable with on what we can do and not do, or Mr.
Clear.
McNulty?
You know, I think to the extent that the commission has specific questions about actions that it'd like to take and wonders whether or not it can, we'll try to field them through my office, and if we need to, we can retain someone outside to advise us on that.
Okay.
We have a little bit of money for things like that when we get into areas that are beyond our general expertise. We have quite a bit of water law knowledge in our staff already, but if we need to, we can go beyond it.
Okay, so if the questions come, we have the resource then to find those answers.
I think so.
Okay.
I think Mr. Wynn's comment was more towards a tutorial on water law and groundwater law, because it is a counterintuitive piece of law and the Constitution of the state. So, and this has been talked about in the RAC and in other places that and this was actually for the Board of Supervisors at a board meeting, but a water law tutorial was what was talked about. And it's a general discussion of why you can or perhaps cannot do the things that you would want to do. And not on a project-specific basis, but on a law basis.
And so that's already been raised with the supervisor.
It's been raised.
And what was the response there?
I don't know. It's out there in the ether somewhere.
Okay. Well, it would be useful. It's
it would be useful.
Yeah. So if somehow that comes along, include us, do please. Other questions at this point? Comments? Okay, I see everybody's ready to go home. So with that, thank you to staff and members of the public who've come on out today and worked hard on this. So we'll look forward to bringing it back on the 23rd and seeing what we can do with on the solution side, possibly. So do I hear a motion to take all the materials we've received into the record and adjourn the meeting? Okay, so moved and seconded?
Second.
Okay, well, with that, all in favor?
Aye.
Okay, this meeting is adjourned. Come back on the 23rd September.